Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. In this particular video, we're going to focus on Dr. Verwoerd and the Jews. Now, Verwoerd, to my knowledge, is probably the only South African leader at any time in the history of South Africa who actually openly spoke about the Jews and openly talked about destroying their economic power. Most certainly after the time of Verwoerd, after he'd been murdered, and we will discuss the Jew who arranged his murder, there wasn't a single white leader who dared to say or do any of the things that Verwoerd did. Verwoerd is definitely the high point of South African racialism. But Verwoerd himself is totally unique in my knowledge of being the only leader to really take on the Jews, talk about the Jews, explain his opposition to the Jews, and also work towards reducing their power, etc. And once you understand that, then you'll see why the Jews absolutely just hate Verwoerd. They hate him. He's the worst thing they ever came across in their time in South Africa. But also in this, you will see yet more examples of how Verwoerd was a Nazi, how he was pro-German, anti-British, and all those kinds of things. And Verwoerd studied in Germany. He studied in Germany at universities where there were Nazi thinkers. But Verwoerd himself, as an academic, deliberately denied that there was anything racial, that there was even a difference between the races. And I think you need to see Verwoerd in the light of the fact that Verwoerd wasn't in power and was operating at a time when South Africa was already at war against Germany on the side of the British, led by the Zionist shill, General Jan Smuts. Jan Smuts was a globalist. He was a big buddy of Churchill. Jan Smuts had Zionist clients for his legal practice. Jan Smuts, like Nelson Mandela, had lots of Jew links and was close to the Jews. And he was the liberal of his time. Though he wasn't a true liberal like modern liberals, he was what you could call a racist liberal. He was liberal, but he was also still racist, because at that time, whites were still much more sane than they are now. But Jan Smuts was a big-time buddy of the British, and he would do anything for Britain. He would sacrifice any South African life for the sake of good old Jewish-run Britain. So when Verwoerd started getting into politics, Smuts was already at his peak and South Africa was already against Germany. So Verwoerd, I think, had to tread carefully in the things that he said and did. And I think that Verwoerd deliberately hid his actual Nazi views. But where you can see it coming out is in his views on race and the absolute determination to split whites from blacks and to split all the races apart, and in his determination to push apartheid on South Africa. And in this video, you will also get to see how Verwoerd actually saved the concept of apartheid. That the whites had voted for this concept, but the leaders were struggling to actually implement it properly until Verwoerd. Verwoerd, the third prime minister in the time of apartheid, he came and solved the problem, and he rammed apartheid down South Africa's throat, and he went on to do the main work of creating apartheid. So I think that Verwoerd was a closet Nazi, but in various ways you will see that the underlying beliefs start coming out in certain things he does and says. And then you see that this man, there's much more to him than meets the eye. He's playing a nice game. He's being very decent and polite. But the reality is, his views are actually extremist. And like I say, there's nothing like Favourite, neither before him nor after him. He is the guy who dares to take on the Jews and say things about Jews that nobody ever, ever does, either before or since. But now I want to give you a little bit of a insight into Favourite the Nazi. And the source for this is a guy called Gerhard Ludi. Gerhard Ludi is a German growing up in South Africa, living in South Africa, and this German later gets involved in intelligence services in the 1960s. And this German goes on to become South Africa's greatest spy. He is so excellent that he infiltrates communism to unbelievably high international levels, to heights I think that even the CIA are amazed by what this German pulls off. But he's a German South African. And we will be returning to Ludi, because when we get to the Jew who orchestrated the killing of Favourite, you'll meet up with Ludi again and some input from him on the matter as well. But I want to read to you about an interesting incident that Ludi experienced. Now, Ludi, in the early 1960s, was at a point involved in a top-secret intelligence organization that the South African government created called the RID, Republican Intelligence Department. And this is from Ludi's book, from page 65, where he has this discussion about a chat with Dr. Favourite. So let me read here. A position as a stringer for the Brazilian news agency, however, provided me, that is Ludi, with a truly fascinating experience in the early 1960s. At Johann Coetzee's suggestion, I attended a meeting of the John X. Merriman branch of the National Party at the Old Carlton Hotel. Just keep in mind, the National Party is the political party that created apartheid. And that's the party that Favourite is a member of. The Nats, that is what they often called the National Party here in South Africa. They called them the Nats. The Nats, feeling increasingly marginalized locally, as well as by the rest of the world, were using this branch to assiduously woo English-speaking South African voters. They only had limited success. After the meeting, I found myself stuck in a lift with Dr. Hendrik Favourite, his bodyguard, and Frank Waring. The power in the city had unexpectedly shut down during a thunderstorm. So he's stuck in a lift with Favourite and two other guys, and the discussion that they have gets interesting. I asked Favourite a few prying questions, and the much maligned Dutch-born premier of the day felt he had to expand a little on my questions, as our situation was very private. He was apparently convinced I was a journalist from Brazil. So meanwhile, it's actually a spy in his own country, one of his own top secret spies that he doesn't know he's talking to. So it continues. It is important to realize that during the 1940s and 1950s, segregation by color was a widely accepted way of life throughout the English-speaking world. Let me just pause there. Exactly what I've been telling you about Rhodesia. Let's continue. People of color were barred from most clubs, restaurants, cinemas, and so forth, while cross-color marriages were either forbidden by law or frowned on throughout the British Empire and much of the United States. The French and Portuguese, who mixed far more freely with their colonial subjects, were considered foolish and degenerate. Prior to National Party rule in 1948, South Africa had been regarded as liberal because of its social and political attitudes towards people of color in the Cape of Good Hope. The Cape, by the way, is the southernmost part of South Africa, and that was traditionally the part of South Africa ruled by Britain. Let's continue. The attitudes of the first two National Party leaders, D.F. Malan and J.G. Strydom, the Lion from the Waterberge, pretty much mirrored the attitude the bulk of their voters had on race. In the eyes of their supporters, the apartheid laws had been promulgated to ensure continued white privilege and to keep the Kaffir and Coolie in his place. So this word Kaffir, this is the South African version of nigger, and Coolie is what they called the Indians. So those were the words people used in those times. "Not anymore," Verwoerd assured me. "We have this wonderful opportunity to create a truly just, peaceful federation of many peoples. Multiracialism just leads to the Brazilian model. It is like a certain type of chocolate cake. There is a thick layer of dark brown at the bottom, with a thin layer of coffee-colored cream above that. Then the cake is topped with pure white cream. That is how the various color groups end up in a multiracial society." And let me just pause there. This is what happened in India in the time of the Aryans, when the Aryans, who were the original white warriors, conquered India. They actually created such a society and turned it into a type of apartheid, but a vertical apartheid, like Verwoerd is saying here. So Verwoerd continues, "The dark people are always at the bottom, lorded over by the light-skinned coloreds, while all of them are lorded over by the whites. I want to end this injustice once and for all. I'm going to remove the discrimination and the tensions these injustices cause by separating race groups into their own living spheres. I want to artificially create a class of skilled black workers, traders, businessmen, and leaders. I want them to be ruled by their own tribal leaders, their laws enforced by their own black policemen, and their children to be educated in their own black schools with black teachers and principals. I want to protect the coloreds from unfair competition by white and Indian shopkeepers and traders, and from rich white and Indian boys from competing with them for their pretty girls. I want to see colored politicians leading them, colored policemen keeping their streets safe, and colored judges sending their criminals to colored jails. And I want to see the same happening in the Indian community." Now listen to this. Listen to what Verwoerd now says. "I want the whites to get off their butts. We need a white class of laborers, people who go out into the fields to do the hard manual work. I want to see white street sweepers. I want to see a new nation of whites who do not expect the dark people to do all their dirty work, to wait on them hand and foot just because of the color of their skin. So let me pause there. What Favut is describing there is Nazism. That's National Socialism. That's the way the Germans lived. That is exactly what the Germans were doing. And here is Favut saying that we need to create a class of white laborers who will do our manual work. In other words, he doesn't want blacks to do our manual labor. He wants us to take care of all our own stuff ourselves. That is National Socialism. He is talking about a whites-only state, and that's Nazism. This man is a total racialist. He doesn't want blacks to be here and do all our dirty work for us. We must take care of everything ourselves. So let's continue with what Ludi says. I sensed Frank Waring and the policeman standing behind Favut were somewhat unenthusiastic at this startling revelation. Surely the people who voted for you know nothing of this, I said, echoing their amazement. The krachtdadige apartheid of Malan and Strijdom and the new rationally justified apartheid of Favut were two totally different animals. So let me pause there. So Malan and Strijdom were the apartheid prime ministers before Favut, and what they were doing is different to what he has in mind. They were looking at using the blacks and keeping the blacks as servants for whites, but Favut is thinking something totally different. He's thinking like a national socialist. So Favut replies to him, "They need to be educated," he conceded. Suddenly, power was restored, and the lift stopped at ground level. Both of us were so engrossed in the debate, however, that Favut led me out of the lift and continued our conversation in the lobby. But the country is so economically integrated. Apartheid cannot succeed without seriously disrupting the economic infrastructure, I argued. Favut replies, "Racial intolerance and tension is worst at the lower classes, where poor people and those of limited education compete for scarce jobs and resources. Such people have to be totally segregated at all costs. It is a price we have to pay for the common good. Once this is done, there is no harm in integrating the upper classes. In the upper classes, there is more racial tolerance. These people will be able to get on with each other, but only once we have created a genuine black, Indian, and colored upper class. This takes time, and one has to be patient before entering that phase." During our discussions, I raised my favorite theme on current South African politics. I agree the apartheid concept of creating separate residential areas for each race removes racial tension. But what about people that want to mix? Surely you would avoid much criticism from many quarters if you declared a fourth group area in all major centers where all those who want to mix and intermarry could do so legally. There could be multiracial private schools, multiracial restaurants, hotels, and everything currently banned in the country. Favut's response was short and sweet, "No," accompanied by a vigorous shaking of his head. So let me pause there. Favut is a total racialist. He's totally racialist. He wants to separate the races, and he will not even tolerate the idea that the races who want to intermix, the people who want to intermix, he doesn't even want to tolerate the notion that they should intermix. He's totally against it. And that then is the end of the discussion. That's as much as Ludi writes about the discussion. But Ludi does write a few more things about Verwoerd, and he says the following. Verwoerd lacked the opportunity to implement his concept of the grand apartheid dream. First, a deranged Magaliesburg farmer, John Pratt, tried to shoot him. Then an even more deranged parliamentary messenger, Dimitri Tsafendas, knifed him to death during a parliamentary session. This is the stuff we'll get to in the next video where we'll discuss Verwoerd's death. But I just want to continue reading about Verwoerd. Ludi writes, I also doubt he could have fooled his electorate to the end of his dream. His successors tried to implement some of the visions of his dream when the Department of Public Works hired hordes of grey uniformed whites as cleaners, and when Forster declared that South Africans of any colour could eat and drink together in any of the country's top hotels and restaurants, provided they had complied with the recently amended Separate Amenities Act by declaring themselves international. But as I predicted, the Afrikaners before 1994 had lived for politics. It was in their blood. So there was no way Verwoerd could ever have fooled them into accepting his vision of apartheid and remaining in power. The rift came when the first tentative steps towards the Verwoerdian dream were taken by John Forster. This is the guy who followed after Verwoerd was killed. The party split into the Verlichters, which is Afrikaans for the Enlightened Ones, and the Verkramptes, which is literally the Cramped Thinkers, led by Herzog. So what Ludi is saying is that the very racial views of Verwoerd, totally splitting the races, completely and utterly, that the whites of South Africa, even the Afrikaans speakers, would never ultimately have accepted that. They still wanted the blacks to be their servants. They still wanted those servants. Whereas Verwoerd is thinking like Hitler. He's thinking exactly like Hitler. He is going to split the races and make each group totally independent of each other from the bottom to the top. Now remember that all of this is for the whites. That this is the arrangement we really want for the whites. And whether the blacks succeed and how they fare when they run their own society from the bottom to the top as black, or whether the Indians, for example, who themselves are often traders and business people, whether any Indians will want to go and sweep their own streets, these things are doubtful. But what does that matter? Verwoerd is trying to split the races so that he can keep the whites racial and pure and together and keep a white society that is able to be self-sufficient. He's thinking totally like a Nazi. This is Nazi thinking. And as you can see, Verwoerd was way ahead of his time. And the people of the time, the whites of that time, would not even probably have accepted it because they still wanted blacks to work for them and serve them and so forth. And, you know, those things were going to go, and we are now far beyond that time. And nowadays, the blacks don't want to work for us. They don't want to serve us. We are far advanced into the splitting off of the races, and Verwoerd was decades ahead of his time. The short video that you're about to see is of a Jewish woman. Her name is Helen Suzman. In the photo, you can see her with Nelson Mandela, the communist terrorist Nelson Mandela, and she's holding his hands, and they're big buddies. Now, Helen Suzman is really the mother of modern white liberalism in South Africa. That's what she is. There was liberalism before her, but it was a liberalism that still had a lot of racialism in it. This was in the time of Jan Smuts. Then after the National Party came to power, then the Jews actually seem to have started the liberalism in the time of apartheid, and she was the leader of it. In true Jewish style, the Liberal Political Party of the Jews changed names every now and then, and it went through a whole set of different changes. But at the end of the day, the bottom line was that she was always in control, and liberalism in South Africa under apartheid was definitely a Jewish thing. And the Jews controlled it totally. So to give you an idea of various political parties that were liberal or controlled by Jews that catered for whites, you had the Liberal Party of South Africa under an Englishman named Alan Paton. Then you had the United Party. Then there was the Progressive Party. And this is where you start seeing lots of Jews. This is also the time when Helen Suzman began getting into Parliament. And she was the main person, the main thinker and driving force behind liberalism. The party changed names. I'm not sure if it became the Reform Party, but I do know that in the time that I got here, there was a party called the Progressive Federal Party, the PFP. And the PFP was Jew-run, mostly Jews, except for the odd white idiot like Frederick van Zyl Slabbert, who's in there. Otherwise, it's just Jews and Jews. Then later on, it became the Democratic Party, also just Jewish names. And it still exists. It's now called the Democratic Alliance. So it's changed its name, but all sorts of Jewish names are associated with it. Names like Colin Eglin, Bernard Friedman, Tony Leon, Helen Ziller, these are all very well-known Jewish names in South Africa. But Helen Suzman was around at the time of Verwoerd, and she detested Verwoerd. And Helen Suzman was even sitting in Parliament the day when Verwoerd was killed. So Helen Suzman is this wealthy Jewish woman who lives in Johannesburg, in one of the upper class suburbs here, the sort of old money suburbs. And as you can see, she's friendly to Mandela, very friendly to Mandela, but like most of the Jews, they totally detested Afrikaner nationalism. They hated it. When I had a Jewish friend and he spoke about Afrikaner nationalism, he would almost go crazy. They hated the Afrikaner nationalists. They hated the National Party. In this very short excerpt, you'll hear her talk about Verwoerd. And you'll hear her say that nobody was talking about Verwoerd for a very long time. He'd been totally forgotten, which is what these people would love. They never want to know about Verwoerd. They detest him. And then she says that the Conservative Party that was created in South Africa in the 1980s, they began to talk about Verwoerd. And you'll see how absolutely disgusted she is with Verwoerd. And I'll play the video twice for you so that you can hear what she says and look at the expression on her face where she says they wish they could forget Verwoerd totally. They don't want to remember that man. They absolutely detest him. And you can hear it in her own words. You can see it on her face and her body language. They totally hated Verwoerd.
Strangely enough, nobody spoke about him at all for years. I mean, until it was all resuscitated by the appearance of the Conservative Party, who then used to talk in glowing terms about Verwoerd and how South Africa would have been, you know, so much better a place if Verwoerd had been still the Prime Minister. The rest of us, I think, were only too glad to forget he ever existed. Strangely enough, nobody spoke about him at all for years. I mean, until it was all resuscitated by the appearance of the Conservative Party, who then used to talk in glowing terms about Verwoerd and how South Africa would have been, you know, so much better a place if Verwoerd had been still the Prime Minister. The rest of us, I think, were only too glad to forget he ever existed.
I want to read some things to you about Verwoerd so that you can understand his view of the Jews, and then you will see clearly what this man was about and why the Jews hated him. They hated him with a passion, and you'll see more proof in here that he's a Nazi. But he's also hiding stuff. So let's start with this article. This is from Wikipedia, and it's in the section called Return to South Africa. Because Verwoerd went and studied in Germany, yes, Germany, in the 1920s. In the early 1920s, before Adolf Hitler became a major figure. And by the time he left Germany, Hitler was on the rise, but Hitler was still far away from actual power. So in this section, Return to South Africa, it says the following. Verwoerd returned with his wife to South Africa in 1928 and was appointed to the chair of applied psychology and psychotechnique at the University of Stellenbosch, where 6 years later he became professor of sociology and social work. Let me just pause there. Verwoerd was absolutely ideal for understanding people, and he was a professor at a very young age already. And he was an academic, and Stellenbosch University is one of the most prestigious Afrikaans universities in South Africa, even now. So it continues. During the Great Depression, Verwoerd became active in social work among poor white South Africans. He devoted much attention to welfare work and was often consulted by welfare organizations while he served on numerous committees. I see that in Wikipedia they say citation needed. Let's continue. Afrikaans politics from 1910 to 1948 were divided between the liberals, such as Jan Smuts, who argued for a reconciliation with Britain, versus the extremists who expressed anti-British sentiments due to the Boer War. Both the liberals and the extremists believed that South Africa was, quotes, a white man's country, end quotes, though the latter were more stridently committed to white supremacy. Verwoerd belonged to the anti-British faction in Afrikaans politics who wanted to keep as much distance as possible from Britain. Let me pause there. Jan Smuts was a general from the Boer War who later teamed up with Jews. He was an attorney. He had Zionists as his customers. And Jan Smuts became the greatest white globalist in South African politics. He became Churchill's bum chum, literally. Churchill would boast how many times he consulted with Jan Smuts because he valued his intellect so highly. Jan Smuts spent lots of time outside South Africa. Smuts was a globalist, and he even played a big role in the creation of Israel. Jan Smuts was a total globalist. The media fawned over him back then in the same way that decades later they would fawn over Nelson Mandela, who also has got Jewish links. And the Jews fawn over Nelson Mandela. But this will give you an idea that the whites were divided between the liberals and the extremists. But back then, liberalism was still racial. No white man ever believed that the blacks should rule South Africa, even Jan Smuts. But it shows you that Verwoerd was firmly on the Boer side, and they were anti-British, and they were also pro-German, as you will discover here. In 1936, Verwoerd, joined by a group of Stellenbosch University professors, protested against the immigration of German Jews to South Africa who were fleeing Nazi persecution. Let me pause there. Very overstated, fleeing Nazi persecution. That in and of itself is a wrong statement there. These people were troublemakers in Germany, and Hitler was busy cleaning up Germany. All the things that happened in Germany, that's a whole other topic. But Jews were involved in communism in Germany. Jews were involved in even assassinations in Germany. There were things happening in Germany that you would not associate with Germany. Bombs were going off, people were being assassinated. It's like a rerun of South Africa later. And it's the same thing that's happening in America now. Do you see the similarities that are occurring in different countries? Once there's a strong Jewish element there, then all kinds of weird things that you've never seen before suddenly appear in those nations. If you go and you actually study German history in the 1920s, you'll actually find that there were Jews who were talking like Julius Malema. I'm not joking with you. In the 1920s, there were Jews in Germany who were inciting people to kill each other, who were inciting revolution. They were openly calling for revolution on the streets, openly doing it. And it's all documented. So I just want to say this stuff of, oh, they were fleeing Nazi persecution. No, the Nazis were busy cleaning up Germany because Jews had been busy with communism in Germany. So it continues. His efforts in the field of national welfare drew him into politics, and in 1936 he was offered the first editorship of Die Transvaaler. That's Afrikaans for The Transvaaler, a new newspaper that belonged to the National Party. These are the radicals, the extremists. A position which he took up in 1937 with the added responsibility of helping to rebuild the National Party of South Africa in the Transvaal. So this is up in Johannesburg, Pretoria. But let's just stop there, because in 1936, Verwoerd and other university professors, academics, were actually protesting against the immigration of German Jews. They said Jews should not be allowed into South Africa. Now, what's also interesting, which we're not going to touch on here, but it happened in that time, was there was a debate in the South African Parliament. There was a debate in the 1930s about this business of accepting Jews into South Africa. There were whites who were saying, we shouldn't allow German Jews to come to South Africa. These are problematic people. And if you actually go and look at certain famous people in South Africa now, famous Jewish people, like Helen Ziller, for example. If you go and look at their actual origins, you'll see that her mommy and daddy were Jews from Germany. These were exactly the same people that whites were saying you should not allow them into the country. And if you go and you study what she went and did, she became a communist. She was in the Black Sash, which was a communist front for the Communist Party of South Africa, and so on. So, you know, there it is. Whites knew what was coming. whites were trying to head it off. They failed. They failed to head it off, and these Jews were coming into South Africa. But the interesting thing is that university professors actually protested back then the fact that Jews were coming into South Africa. Can you believe that? Shows you academics back then were totally different. So it continues. Die Transvaal was a publication which supported the aspirations of Afrikaner nationalism, agriculture and labor rights. Combining republicanism, populism and protectionism, the paper helped solidify the sentiments of most South Africans that changes to the socio-economic system were vitally needed. With the start of the Second World War in September 1939, Verwoerd protested against South Africa's role in the conflict when the country declared war on Germany, siding with its former colonial power, the United Kingdom. So, Verwoerd openly was against South Africa entering the war on the side of Britain. There's a whole issue about all the South African whites who were pro-German but who remained underground during the duration of the war. There were a number of pro-Nazi, pro-German, pro-fascist organizations. There were the English Grey Shirts in South Africa, who were fascists. And you had, among the Afrikaans people, you had the Ossewaard Brandwach and the OB. The Ossewaard Brandwach, or the OB, they were extremists who were pro-Nazi and pro-German. And at their peak, there were 600,000 of them in South Africa. But sadly, these people didn't come and help the Germans in a military way. That's a whole other debate for another day. But Verwoerd, as the editor of the Transvaaler, used his position as editor to speak about his pro-German viewpoints and so on. And as the editor of the Transvaaler, Verwoerd may actually be one of the most key people in South Africa who helped to create a pro-German, pro-Nazi sentiment. He may well have been very influential in helping to create that pro-German sentiment. There had already been pro-German sentiment already from even before the Boer War, but as the editor of the Transvaaler, he may have had a very powerful influence on the whites. And this comes out in a very weird thing that happened in 1943. In the middle of the war in 1943, it says, Verwoerd, editor of Die Transvaaler, sued the English language newspaper, The Star, after it accused him of being a Nazi propagandist. Let me just pause there. The Star newspaper is, to this day, one of the biggest newspapers in South Africa. But something that I've heard, but I've not been able to actually check it fully, is that the Star newspaper in South Africa, which is a liberal newspaper, the Star originally was apparently a Red Star. And the Star newspaper may actually have been a communist creation or influenced by communism, and later, of course, it looked liberal. But if you study history enough, you'll find that liberalism and communism are buddies. Okay? Liberals are not really on the side of whites, and white liberals don't know it, but they're already halfway into enemy territory. So if you're a liberal, you're already halfway to becoming a communist. And liberalism and communism, these two things are not far apart. I used to think otherwise when I was younger and dumber, but that's not true. So anyway, so here is the Star newspaper, which is under English control, and it says that he's a Nazi propagandist. So you must understand, South Africa was at war And Smuts, you know, had put South Africa on the side of the English. So this was a bit of a problem for Verwoerd. So he did something, and he did something that he failed at. But this failure proves exactly what we need to know here. So Verwoerd goes and he sues the Star newspaper. And then the judge dismisses the case. So the case doesn't even go to trial. The case is just thrown out of court right up front, okay? It's thrown out of court up front, and the judge says the following. In his judgment dismissing the case, Justice Malan stated that Verwoerd did support Nazi propaganda. He did make his paper a tool of Nazis in South Africa, and he knew it. And yeah, that's it. That's it. The judge says, look, you do support Nazi propaganda. Your newspaper is a paper that is a tool of the Nazis in South Africa, and you know it. You know, just, you know, sort of go jump. So that should show you right there that anybody who was a reader of Die Transvaaler, they knew what it was about. They knew what Verwoerd's real stance was. He's totally pro-Nazi. Die Transvaaler is totally pro-Nazi, and so on. But it's no big secret. It's not like anybody knows. The Star newspaper is merely stating the obvious. I just want to read a little bit from a website called ChristiansForTruth.com. They're actually an excellent website, absolutely excellent, and they are exposing Jews very often. They have an article where they quote a guy called Stephen Goodson. Stephen Goodson used to be a director of the South African Reserve Bank, and later he abandoned his position and he became an author and a right-wing activist. And he died under rather mysterious conditions a year or two ago. I had a little bit of interaction with Stephen Goodson, and I bought his books. He wrote a couple of short books. He wrote books exposing Jan Smuts and Jan Smuts's Jewish links, and he wrote a book praising Dr. Verwoerd. There were a couple of things that Goodson did that I didn't agree with. He wrote a book attacking Ian Smith, and it's very much similar to what a lot of Rhodesians are doing these days. But I've read the book, I have a copy of the book, and the basic argument in the book is a lot like the argument against Hitler. The argument goes something like this. It is, Ian Smith was a traitor because he led us to war because we lost. It's a similar kind of view that some people have of Hitler. Hitler is a traitor because he led us to war because we lost. It's actually a junk argument. It's really a junk argument because it does not take into account the conditions of the time, and it doesn't explain what they were trying to do. So his book on Ian Smith is by far the weakest book. It's a book that I totally dismiss. And even Dr. Peter Hammond, who was a close friend of Stephen Goodson, did tell me that he himself told Goodson that the argument about Ian Smith is junk. Because Peter Hammond himself grew up in Rhodesia, and he even met Ian Smith and spoke to him, and he knew Ian Smith personally. Now, in Goodson's book about Verwoerd, he claims that Verwoerd was killed by the bankers and so forth, but that's not quite true. That's why we're going to be looking at the closest source to the actual death of Verwoerd. And we will get real details of the man who was controlling all the assassinations, who was Jewish. So I even had a few chats with Goodson. I probably still have a couple of his emails lying around where I tried to raise some issues with him before he passed away. And we did talk a bit about this thing about who killed Verwoerd. And later, I think in later copies, he modified his book a little bit to include some of that. But I want to quote a most important thing that Christians for Truth raise that comes from Goodson that also gives an insight into what Verwoerd was up to. Because Verwoerd was probably on his path to sorting out the super rich. So, from Christians for Truth, it says the following. Dr. Verwoerd was an implacable foe of the money power, Stephen Goodson tells us. And money power is just the other term for Jews. So, let's continue. Stephen Goodson tells us, and wanted to achieve independence for South Africa. He commissioned the Hoek Report, and Hoek is Afrikaans, and it's spelled H-O-E-K. He commissioned the Hoek Report from Professor Piet Hoek of Pretoria University, and the report showed that the Anglo-American Corporation controlled the English language newspapers and 70% of all companies in South Africa while paying 10% tax. So let me just pause there. Anglo-American is owned by the Jewish Oppenheimer family. So it's a total monopoly. Anglo-American is a monopoly. In fact, Anglo-American was such a powerful monopoly that inside the United States, I think, even banned Anglo-American from functioning in America because it was a total global monopoly of the diamond market. Anglo-American is a Jewish family-owned company that had a total global hold on the diamond market everywhere. And Anglo-American, owned by the Jewish Oppenheimers, here it says, the Hoek Report said, controlled the English language newspapers. So there you have Jewish control of all the English language newspapers in South Africa. That's what Professor Piet Hoek was telling Verwoerd. And it owned 70% of all the companies in South Africa. That's how powerful Anglo-American was. And Anglo-American is still globalist. It's moved out of South Africa. It's downgraded a lot of its South African holdings, but it's got holdings all across the world. And it's still owned by the Oppenheimer family. So, continuing on, it says, the Anglo-American Corporation also controlled the English language universities. Its Jewish chief executive, Harry F. Oppenheimer, was chairman of the South African Institute of International Affairs, and his corporate subordinates occupied the councils of the English language universities. Pretending to be an honest enterprise, the Institute promoted the interests of international corporations and still does. The political message taught to the students was controlled by Oppenheimer and his associates. So that's from Christians for Truth. And that's basically a summary from what Stephen Goodson wrote. I now want to read to you from an article from a website called South African History Online. And I want to read 2 points here because it will again show you the racial angles of Verwoerd and also his attitude to Jews and why Verwoerd and Jews did not get along. So it says, in his biography of the man Verwoerd, architect of apartheid, Henry Kenny noted that Verwoerd had a dominating personality, and those who came under his influence found him irresistible. This seems to have been one of those cases where that much abused word charismatic is applicable. Verwoerd's intellectual powers were clearly formidable. Supremely self-confident, he never doubted the correctness of his views. It was an outstanding characteristic of Verwoerd that once having made up his mind, it was virtually impossible to make him change it. Let me just stop there and just start at the beginning there. It says, Kenny noted that Favut had a, quote, dominating personality, and those who came under his influence found him irresistible. So this should give you an idea that he was like Hitler in the sense of his ability to influence those around him. He had an extremely powerful persona, and his personality, backed up by his formidable intellectual powers, just made him make people melt. People melted in his presence. He's like Hitler. Hitler is a highly intellectual character. George Lincoln Rockwell in America is not quite the same, but he does have that firmness. He doesn't have that deep intellect of Hitler and deep intellect of Favut. But then again, I mustn't sell Rockwell short. Rockwell was no fool. Rockwell did understand a lot of stuff, and he taught himself quickly. But in terms of depth, big term, long term depth of knowledge, Hitler and Favut are clearly different characters. Of course, with Hitler being the top of the pops, Hitler reading entire libraries of books. But again, it's just to show you that Favut may have spoken softly, but his mind was sharp. And you weren't going to change his mind on anything. And in this regard, he's unique among the South African leaders. Favut is not a man you can push around. You're not going to make him do what you want him to do. He is going to go down his path. End of story. And when we look at some of the other South African leaders that come afterwards, because I want to show you the Jewish influence afterwards, you will see weak, pathetic people. You'll even see somebody who's actually a right-wing racist, and then he melts when he's faced with Jews and blacks and everything. Totally melts and can't stand his ground, etc., etc. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why Favut has to be killed. You have to kill him because you're not going to get him to change his mind. He cannot be changed. He's firm, he's determined, he's going to do what he's going to do. The only way you're going to stop Favut is to kill him. Either get him out of power or kill him. And in the end, they go for killing him because he's far too effective. He's getting too much done. He's way too dangerous to the globalists, to the Jews, to communism. He's busy smashing all of the enemies back. Okay, so let's continue here. In order to give some indication of how Favut sought to rationalize the imposition of demographic representativity in 1930s white South Africa, something which he was not able to put into practice, and then apartheid post-1948, which he was, below are 10 extended quotes illustrating some of his reasoning. So, the first one. As an early proponent of employment equity. Number one. A possible solution to Jewish domination of the economy of South Africa. So, right up the top there, Jews dominate the South African economy. And Favut was against it in the 1930s. We're talking 90 years later, nothing has changed. Below are the possible ways in which the state can help Afrikaners gain their necessary share of commerce and industry. Let me also just clarify this sentence. Remember, South African society is divided between the English and the Afrikaans. The Afrikaans speakers, the Boers, these are the majority of the whites. They make up anything from 60 to 66% of the white population. And then the remainder of the population is English. And hidden in the English are the Jews. Now, I had an uncle who later was a business success. And my uncle told me that in the 1920s, if you were an Afrikaans speaker in South Africa, you could not get into business. The English were pushing you out of business. You could not enter business. And of course, hidden in and among the English are Jews. So Jews and English are so intertwined, you struggle to figure out where the one starts and where the other one ends. And basically, Afrikaans speakers, who made up the majority of the population of the whites of South Africa, were prevented from entering business. My own uncle told me this. So anyway, this is why Verwoerd is talking about the Afrikaans speakers being at a disadvantage. So it continues. The country's commerce and industry is still busy developing. In the first place, this expansion must be placed at the disposal of the English and Afrikaans-speaking parts of the population, presently being disadvantaged in these fields. So Verwoerd clearly distinguishes between Jews and normal English speakers and the Afrikaans people. So he clearly distinguishes between the normal English and the Afrikaans speakers, saying that English and Afrikaans speaking parts of the population are at a disadvantage against the Jews. So it continues here. Legislation must gradually but purposefully ensure that each white section of the population should, as far as practicable, enjoy a share of each of the major occupations according to its proportion of the white population. So let me pause there. So he wants racial quotas. He wants the English and the Afrikaans people to get equal opportunities in jobs according to their proportion of the white population. He always treats the English equal with the Afrikaans speakers. Right throughout his time, this man was a total racialist. He wanted the English and the Afrikaans to work together. That's what Verwoerd strove for all the time. This is yet another sign that he was a clear Nazi, a clear racialist, that the English and the Afrikaans must each get the same benefits and they must have the same burdens and they all have the same responsibility. As you saw in the previous video, where he said that the English and Afrikaans speakers own South Africa and it's their country. He said that quite clearly. So, let's continue. This situation is called balanced distribution, but it has also been called a quota system. As Jews presently enjoy a disproportionate share of the wholesale and retail trade, such a balanced distribution can be achieved only by refusing them further trading licenses until such a time as the other main population groups, such as English and Afrikaans speakers, have gained a proportion which, as far as practicable, corresponds to their percentage of the white population. When trading licenses held by Jews lapse due to special circumstances, they may not be allocated to compatriots, in other words, other Jews, until all other population groups have achieved the above-mentioned equal privileges in this regard. However, this does not include the normal transfer of a business from father to son. So if a Jew hands his business over to the son, then it's still okay. He's not going to take the business away. Then the next quote, this was when he was the editor of the Transvaaler. This was written on the 1st of October 1937. Demographic proportionality is the goal. This is also what Verwoerd wrote. Another possible way of aiding this process could be proposed. The establishment of an industrial bank, similar to the institutions responsible for the German industrial flowering after 1870, and that of Japan from the beginning of this century, would promote the general development of industry in the Union of South Africa. Such a bank, which would have to enjoy government support, would be responsible for the establishment and financing of new industries. Such an industrial bank could be used as an instrument to give Afrikaners who lack capital but have the requisite expertise the chance to achieve leadership in various industries. This could happen as it did at ISCOR. Let me just pause there. ISCOR is South African Iron and Steel. So this was a major iron and steel producer, and this was one of the early companies that they created. So he's saying this could happen as it did at ISCOR, where young Afrikaners without capital but with the right skills and personality traits became part of the management of an extensive industry. Let me just pause again. Remember now, the Afrikaans speakers, the Boers, have taken big hits in the Anglo-Boer War 37 years earlier. So it's also to pick up these people who've also lost everything. You know, the British came, they burned down 30,000 farms. The British shot millions of animals that belonged to the Boers, I must tell you. And that's over and above the women and children who died in the concentration camps, which is a source of great bitterness even to this day. But the point that Verwoerd is making is that if people have got the skills and intelligence, you must give them opportunity. And you've got all these Afrikaans speakers who aren't getting opportunities. And you need to give them opportunities and allow them to grow. They're going to be a benefit to the country. That is exactly the kind of viewpoint that Hitler had. Hitler was even talking about the children of the poor, that you've got to take the children and give them an education, because even among the poor, you're going to find very talented children. These things are not sentimental views. This stuff is scientific. This is how it happens with breeding. In the DNA, even among the poor people, there are going to be very talented children coming out, and you need to give these children a chance. If you give those kids a chance, those kids could have a tremendously positive effect on the country. So it's about giving people with talent a chance. Give them a chance and let them grow, and the country will benefit from it. Very much the same kind of view as Hitler. So it continues, in the allocation of capital and top management posts, the banking institution would discriminate against the Jew until a stage is reached where the Jew and the English and the Afrikaans speakers enjoyed a share of industry proportional to their percentage of the population. So he's saying that Jews would also have quotas that have to match the same quotas as the English and the Afrikaans speakers. And you can imagine, the Jews hated that. They want to dominate and grab as much of the economy as they possibly can. So it ends by saying, of course, the discrimination must disappear as soon as the correct balance has been achieved. So I'm going to stop there on point number 2. We will actually return to all the 10 points in this article, because it contains lots of stuff that he said about the blacks. He spoke about the future. Verwoerd even said, this I will throw in here. Verwoerd stated, and this is way ahead of his time, hey? Verwoerd stated that multiracial democracy would lead to black domination. Why? Because the blacks are the majority of the population. Even at that stage when he was running the country, the whites were down to 19% of the country. So Verwoerd stated quite clearly that the moment you have multiracial democracy, the blacks would end up dominating the country. But here's an interesting prediction that he made. He predicted that if the blacks dominated the country, that it would then destroy the other minorities, the other non-white minorities, that black domination would lead to the destruction of the other non-white minorities, which clearly would be the Indians, the Asians, and the coloreds. And these are topics we will discuss later. And I also want to just state clearly that you must understand in history the importance of will to power. It's a topic I'm going to come back to again and again, will to power. That this is what Nietzsche spoke about. This is natural. This is natural in the animal world. It's natural in the human world. Everybody strives for more power. That includes the Jews. That includes the blacks. And so whoever gets a chance to dominate, they will try to continue dominating as much as possible, and they will resist any change. The Jews will resist change, and the blacks will resist change. And it is quite natural, therefore, that the blacks will try to gain total power of South Africa, which is what they are doing, and they are doing their utmost to entrench themselves now. And this is very natural. They will do this. And what whites need to learn is we need to relearn our will to power, and we also have to strive for power. Power is important, and we've been giving away far too much power, listening to too much liberal nonsense, and whites everywhere need to get back to striving for power, striving for power aggressively and determinedly. Because if you don't do it, everybody else is doing it. Everyone else is busy doing it. And it's that simple. Now we're going to take a look at another article. Also one of those rare articles where they actually talk about the Jews and Verwoerd. This comes from a website and it was published in 2014. And it's an analysis by a guy called Stanley Ace on Hendrik Verwoerd. And this is very detailed. So, it says, Dr. Hendrik French Verwoerd, Prime Minister of South Africa, Stanley Ace, political correspondent of the Sunday Times, South Africa, Volume 3, Number 2, January to March, 1959. Okay, it says, like so many racialists, Dr. Verwoerd had his early training in anti-Semitism. In the mid-1930s, when he was professor of applied psychology at Stellenbosch University, Afrikaanderdom's oldest seat of learning, he accompanied five fellow professors on a deputation to the Herzog Smuts government to protest against the admission into South Africa of Jewish refugees from Hitler's Germany. A year later, in 1937, when the high priests of Nationalist Afrikaanderdom selected him for the editorship of the new nationalist daily newspaper in Johannesburg, the Transvaaler, Dr. Verwoerd wrote his first leading article on the Jews. And these seem to be direct quotes from him. It says, "The nationalist does not hate the Jews," he said reassuringly. But he added, "There was a clash of interests between the Jew and the Afrikaner." Let me just pause there. The term Afrikaner, as used in those times and right up to modern times, the term Afrikaner includes the Boers. So these are the Afrikaans speakers, but it includes the Boers. So let's continue. He added there was a clash of interests between the Jew and the Afrikaner, and the Afrikaner had found that commercial and industrial undertakings were mostly in, quotes, foreign hands, latterly mostly Jews. Let me pause there. You see, this is what happens, is you have this foreign colonization, this globalist colonization of your economy. I've brought this up before, but here is Verwoerd saying it himself, that most of commerce and industry is in foreign hands, non-South African hands, these foreigners who come and settle in your country. And he says they're latterly mostly Jews. This stuff is true. This stuff is true. Let's continue. This population group, wrote Dr. Verwoerd, which always separates itself within the population as a separate unit, and which is somewhat unfeeling and even hostile towards the nationalist aspirations of Afrikanerdom, has also been seen, therefore, as a group which stands in the way of the Afrikaner's economic welfare. The struggle had sharpened as a result of Jewish immigration, stated Dr. Verwoerd, and the solution was that by legislation it must be ensured gradually but deliberately that each white population group, as far as possible, has a share in each of the most important occupations in accordance with the proportion it forms of the white population as a whole. So let me pause there. This is the same as what we saw in the previous article, that Jews are seen as whites, but this group of whites disproportionately controls the economic system and everything that's important. And Verwoerd is saying, basically, you need a racial quota inside the, quotes, race, because he wants to see that the English get a fair share, the Afrikaners get a fair share, and this dominance and monopoly of Jews needs to be taken care of. So it continues. Dr. Verwoerd proposed restrictions on trading licenses and other discriminatory measures. Dr. Verwoerd's assurance that the nationalist does not hate the Jew was contradicted, in his own case at least, by the string of anti-Semitic articles which appeared in the Transvaaler and which continued through the war years, that is World War II. So you can see, even this guy is saying, this Englishman is saying, that Verwoerd was telling the truth about the Jews before the war and through the war. And as we've seen, he was pro-German as well during the war, pro-Nazi. This resulted, soon after the launching of the newspaper, in the Jewish community of Johannesburg boycotting the advertisement columns. This promptly evoked a complaint from the Hurt editor. So the Jews were boycotting his newspaper and not placing adverts in his newspaper. Nothing of this was recalled by the Transvaaler when it celebrated its 21st anniversary during October this year. Jewish memories were stirred, however, and the year he's referring to is 1959. And he says, Jewish memories were stirred, however, and Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronoth expressed the fear that South Africa's new prime minister would pursue an anti-Israel policy in international affairs and an anti-Semitic policy in domestic affairs. A Jewish member of the Nationalist Party approached Dr. Verwoerd for a repudiation of these fears. Let me just pause there. So the Nationalist Party, which was in its early days anti-Semitic, clearly now has got some Jews in it. So the Jew goes to Dr. Verwoerd, and this is what happens. And Dr. Verwoerd told him briefly that he was, quotes, continuing the policy of Dr. Milan and Mr. Stradom. There was little comfort in his curt reply. Some Jews thought it ironical that Mr. Max Melamed, chairman of the Jewish Board of Deputies in Cape Town, should describe the report in Yedioth Akronoth as stupid and without foundation because Mr. Melamed was one of the board's principal lobbyists when the Nationalist Party under Dr. Milan introduced an opposition bill in Parliament aimed at prohibiting Jewish immigration. If anyone should have been aware of the Nationalist government's anti-Semitic background, it was Mr. Melamed. In the parliamentary debate on January 14, 1937, let me pause there. This parliamentary debate from 1937 is actually a very important topic, and that will be a separate video, because the Jewish immigration issue was discussed in the South African Parliament among the whites, and there were whites in the Parliament saying that Jews should not be allowed into South Africa. This debate did take place, 1937. But this was before Verwoerd himself was in Parliament. Anyway, let's continue. So, regarding the parliamentary debate, on January 14, 1937, the Nationalist Party called for prohibition of Jewish immigration, deletion of Yiddish as a recognized European language for immigration purposes, no further naturalization of Jewish immigrants, closing of certain professions to Jews and other non-assimilable races, and prohibition of changing of names, retrospective from May 1st, 1930. So let me pause there. There's a bunch of Jewish things in here that are worth commenting on. The changing of Jewish names, that's a trick that Jews use right up to the modern times in America. People have done videos about it. All the Jewish names that were changed to sound non-Jewish. Lots of famous actors in Hollywood got rid of their Jewish names, etc. So in South Africa, actually prohibiting Jews from changing their names, and also that they didn't want people who cannot be assimilated. That is a very important point. That is actually something that Napoleon brought up when he was busy with the Jewish issue in France. He was raising this issue that the Jews are not becoming proper French citizens and they are not carrying out the duties expected of a citizen. You see, this is the same old thing repeating itself over and over again. Whether it's France or Germany or wherever, it's always the same old thing. So let's continue. Since assuming office in 1948, the Nationalist government, for reasons of expediency, has professed a desire to be friendly with the Jews, yet anti-Semitism has never been far beneath the surface of parliamentary debates. Dr. Verwoerd himself has not been able to conceal his anti-Semitism. Recently, he suggested that he had been denied justice in a court case during World War II because the judge, Millen, was Jewish. Let me pause there. This may actually be the instance when Verwoerd sued the Star newspaper, I think it was, for saying that he was pro-Nazi, and he sued them over that, and he lost, and the case was dismissed. So it seems the judge was Jewish. Well, the judge said that he was pro-Nazi, so I'm not doubting that. There's other evidence to show that he was pro-Nazi. Anyway, let's continue. From this basic training in anti-Semitism, Dr. Favut moved on to much more grandiose concepts of race purity, involving the entire South African nation of 9.6 million Africans, 3 million whites, 1.3 million coloreds, and 441,000 Indians. Himself Hollander born, he brought to the nationalist Afrikaner's crude race theories stray refinements of ideology and presentation, the product, no doubt, of his in the mid-1920s when Nazism was born at the universities of Leipzig, Hamburg, and Berlin. So that's interesting. So they say that there was a lot of Nazi thinking going on at German universities, the very ones that Favut attended. From an early age, he had shown a preference for German institutions and a dislike of British ones. As late as his 55th birthday, 1957, he had placed on record that the principal of the Milton Boys High School in Bulawayo, that's Rhodesia, had literally kicked him down the corridor because he had expressed a desire to return to the Union, where the country's entry into World War I had provoked an armed rebellion among a section of the Boers. You must remember, Rhodesia was totally loyal to Britain. Until Britain shafted Rhodesia up its ass. So that's how Britain repays their loyalty. Jewish Britain. So let's continue. The headmaster was outraged at the thought of the young Favut, by all accounts a good scholar, wanting to return to that nest of rebels. The nest of rebels being the Boers. And little did those Rhodesians know that a couple of decades later, they would be the rebels. So it continues. Dr. Favut's father, now 84 and running a small bookshop with the aid of his wife in the Free State village of Brandfort, had been a missionary. When they arrived in Cape Town from Amsterdam, the father established a grocery business in Wynberg and in his spare time spread the gospel among the neighboring coloreds. 50 years later, the government, in which his son, Hendrik, was Minister of Native Affairs, took away the century-old voting rights of those colored people. Perhaps the incident at the Milton Boys High School brought a certain bitterness to the young Favut's soul. Back in the Union of South Africa, the family settled in Brandfort, where Hendrik matriculated. Then he went to Stellenbosch University. He obtained his MA degree in the young science of psychology, also sociology and logic, with distinctions, and became eligible for an Abe Bailey bursary of £400 a year. This would have meant going to Oxford University. However, he turned it down. "I preferred to study psychology at a continental university," he explained later. Later, he took his doctorate in psychology, and this time he went abroad to the universities of Leipzig, Hamburg, and Berlin, on a much smaller bursary than the Abe Bailey one. It was the last time Hendrik Favut left South Africa. So you see, remember that Favut's father had come to South Africa because he was very fond of the Boers. He felt a real solidarity with the Boers because of the nasty way the British had treated them. And so Favut himself has a detestation of the Boers. And the Boers liked the Germans. And you can see that Favut did the same thing. So even if it meant a smaller bursary, he still preferred to go and study in Germany in the 1920s, as the Nazis were rising. Spurning the Abe Bailey bursary was not a casual act. Dr. Favut's anti-Semitism was matched by his anti-British outlook. During the royal visit to South Africa in 1947, he had refused to print a single word or picture of the event in the Transvaaler. On the day the royal family arrived in Johannesburg, he wrote a leading article on drought. Even the Burger, the Cape nationalist newspaper, recognized the newsworthiness of the occasion. By then, Dr. Favut was well known for his pro-Nazi views. Mr. Justice Millen, in a judgment delivered in the Transvaal Supreme Court on July 13, 1943, pronounced, he, Favut, did support Nazi propaganda, he did make his paper a tool of the Nazis in South Africa, and he knew it. This, of course, is the Jewish judge Millen. So, you see, in those days, South Africa was a dominion. It was like Canada, and Britain controlled it. And the royal family had a real position in South Africa. So here's the royal family pitching up, and Favut totally snubs the entire royal visit, as if they don't even exist. So these things should give you an idea of where Favut's heart and soul was. He totally had no time for the royals, the British, the Jews. He wanted no part of any of this stuff. This guy was a racialist. So here's more about the court case, and it's worth looking at. The case arose out of an action brought by Dr. Favut as editor of the Transvaaler against the Johannesburg Star for publishing an article entitled Speaking Up for Hitler. See, Favut was promoting Hitler, in which the Transvaaler was accused of falsifying news in support of Nazi propaganda and generally acting as a tool of the enemy. Remember, South Africa was fighting on the side of the Jewish British. Dr. Favut lost the case. In a lengthy judgment extending to more than 2,000 words, the judge found that Dr. Favut had in fact furthered Nazi propaganda. The defendants had proved, said the judge, that Dr. Favut caused to be published a large body of matter which was on the same general lines as matter coming to the Union in the Afrikaans transmissions from Zeeson and which was calculated to make the Germans look upon the Transvaaler as the most useful adjunct to this propaganda service. On another point, the judge said, this is a falsification of current news which was approved by the plaintiff. It was calculated to cause alarm and despondency, and it is not open to doubt that it was of great service to the enemy in the way of supporting his propaganda for the damaging of the war effort of the Union. So it seems the Germans had a radio service that was broadcasting into South Africa in Afrikaans. This is where that friend of mine, who I refer to as my Boer Nazi pal, he said that there were something like 600,000 white South Africans who were on the side of the Ossewaer Brandwacht, or the OB. These were the pro-German group in South Africa. And of course the Germans were hoping they would rebel, but that didn't happen. But the bottom line is basically that Favut was operating almost like the alternative news of his time, when everybody else is pumping out Jewish-British stories. Here was the Transvaaler pumping out German information. And now, just like in modern-day America, you've got the liberals and the Jews of that time hating the fact that Favut is publishing stuff that puts the Germans in a positive light and gives out the news from the German point of view. So let's continue. Here is a further extract from the court record. Mr. Roper, for the defendants, and this is what Mr. Roper says, here is a thoroughly defeatist article saying that the Germans are on the threshold of England, that it is imperative for Britain to make peace, and that these peace feelers are really inspired by her. Not a very comforting article for those not in your camp. And this is Verwoerd. It appears this is Verwoerd in court. And Dr. Verwoerd says, it is not my business to comfort the English. The judge concludes, there have been proved two very grave cases of the publication of false news. Let me just stop there. Doesn't this sound like 2021, where we hear fake news and accusations that different sides are publishing fake news since the time of Trump? And here you can see, here the same thing is going on in 1943 South Africa. Rerun, the liberal side, the liberal Jewish side referring to Verwoerd stuff as the fake news. There you go. History is just repeating itself, man. Let's continue. Of the publication of false news, in reckless disregard of whether these were true or false, 6 cases, on the whole less serious, but still clear cases of falsification where news originally correctly reported was falsely restated for the purpose of editorial comment, and the 2 cases in which news was falsified by means of misleading headlines. So here you have Verwoerd publishing stuff from a German point of view, and those of you who've studied World War II stuff, you know that all these decades later we can show the Germans were telling the truth all along. And Verwoerd was publishing that stuff, but here they are saying, oh no, it's falsified. Believe Britain. Believe lying Britain. Let's continue. The plaintiff, Dr. Verwoerd, appeals to the principles of free speech and a free press in a democratic country in justifying him in writing, as he did it in support of his policy of neutrality and a separate peace between the Union and Germany as a means towards a republic in South Africa. He argues that if he has to consider whether what he says would be useful to the Germans, the effect would be to silence him, and the law does not compel him to be silent. But the question in this case is not whether the plaintiff should be silenced. His legal right to publish what he did is not in question. The question is whether, when he exercises his legal right in the way he does, he is entitled to complain when it is said of him that what he writes supports Nazi propaganda and makes his paper a tool of the Nazis. On the evidence, he is not entitled to complain. He did support Nazi propaganda. An Afrikaner nationalist by adoption instead of by birth, Dr. Verwoerd became the first South African Prime Minister with no claim to a traditional Boer upbringing. The Boer War and its bitter aftermath left no scars on him. When Strydom was bumping across the Transvaal Platteland in an old red Ford, he was strolling under Stellenbosch's shady oaks when other party stalwarts were fighting their way grimly to the top. He was plucked from his professor's chair and given control of the Transvaaler. In his first election contest, Alberton, and by the way, Alberton is somewhat to the south of where I live in Johannesburg, Alberton in the 1948 election, he was beaten by the United Party. The United Party was the name of the Liberals of the time. The United Party were the Liberals. Subsequently, he entered Parliament as a nominated senator. Only in the April 1948, I think it is, general election, was the safe Heidelberg seat vacated for him, and he took his seat in the assembly for the first time as an MP. 4.5 months later, he became Prime Minister. Even then, his election as Prime Minister was curiously violent. It was the first time the Nationalist Party had voted for its leader instead of selecting him automatically. Until the last moment, the country was kept guessing as to whether it would be the senior cabinet minister and acting prime minister, Charles Roberts Swart, who had set his heart on this ultimate honor, or the suave Dr. Eben Dongers, minister of the interior and leader of the Cape Nationalists, on whom the mantle of ex-premier Milan had fallen, or the turbulent newcomer from the north. The Nationalist Parliamentary Caucus went to extraordinary lengths to ensure secrecy at the balloting for the new Hoofleier, who will automatically become Prime Minister. The windows of the caucus room in the parliamentary buildings were pasted up with cardboard. Ballot papers were issued, specially stamped with the letters NP, National Party, to avoid forgeries. Only the party whips knew about the secret NP stamp before the balloting began. The 173 members of the caucus, excluding the three candidates, voted in groups of four at specially erected cubicles to ensure secrecy. In this democratic atmosphere, the caucus chose its new leader. At the first ballot, Swart polled 41 votes, Dongers 52, and Verwoerd 80. At the second ballot, after Swart had been eliminated, Dongers polled 75 votes and Verwoerd 98, giving the latter a majority of 23 votes. Of the 173 members of the caucus who voted, more than 70 came from the enlarged Senate, which in 1955 had been increased in size from 48 to 90 members, to give the nationalist government the two-thirds majority required to remove the coloured voters from the common roll. From 1950 to 1958, Dr. Verwoerd was leader of the government side of the Senate, assiduously cultivating the support of the government senators. Therefore, when the time came to elect a successor to Strijdom, the enlarged Senate, the epitome of the undemocratic spirit in South Africa, played a decisive role. This sounds kind of boring to me. All this nonsense of blah, 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 undemocratic, yada, yada, yada. Let these people run their affairs their way. This sounds like some British whining and crying about the South African system. No doubt to discredit Verwoerd, you know, like, oh, Hitler, he was a dictator. Mussolini was a dictator. Meanwhile, all those guys came to power properly. Although Dr. Verwoerd could not command the support either of all the senior members of the cabinet or of the rank and file of the Nationalist Party, nevertheless he was the obvious choice for the post. As one commentator put it, he is the key man in the Nationalist government, and to have denied him the premiership would have been both illogical and evasive. Dr. Verwoerd was brought in to lead the Nationalist Party almost as an act of desperation. After 10 years of nationalist rule, let me pause there. When they're talking 10 years of nationalist rule, they're talking 10 years of apartheid. So remember, this is apartheid time. So let's just check this again. And it says, after 10 years of nationalist rule, during which it had become increasingly urgent to find an answer to the question, what is apartheid? The government had come to the crossroads. Only Dr. Verwoerd stood out as the man who claimed to know the answer. He confessed once to an interviewer that he never suffered the qualms of doubt. He always knew he was right. It was just someone like this that the Nationalist Party wanted, someone who would face the future with absolute confidence and banish the gnawing anxiety over the fate of apartheid. So let me pause there. This could well explain why, even though Verwoerd was one of the three original guys who led the country under apartheid, it's him who pushes forward and goes where the others who were supposed to didn't have the determination and the guts to go. Verwoerd took them down the path, and he was absolutely determined. Interesting that he's very confident and he says he doesn't suffer from qualms of doubt. Sounds very much like Hitler, who knows what he's doing. He's totally confident in himself, and he knows what he's doing is the proper thing. End of story. See, when white leaders are strong and determined and they know what they're doing and they don't have to run around begging lobbyists and whining and crying and trying to accommodate everybody, but the leader himself is confident in his own knowledge and in his own ability and he knows the direction he wants to take, well, there you go. And Verwoerd went on to become the best. So let's continue. To quote again the commentator mentioned above, nationalist Afrikanerdom, for the first time perhaps, is beginning to feel the pressure of history on its shoulders and the immense implications of the apartheid task. It has discovered, too, that apartheid cannot be checked and released at will, like water in an irrigation furrow. It has its own irresistible momentum. Nationalist Afrikanerdom's whole future has been entrusted to one man, Dr. Verwoerd. If Dr. Verwoerd fails, Afrikanerdom fails. Dr. Verwoerd is only 58 and apparently in excellent health. He is tireless, dedicated, and determined. The circumstances are classic in their perfection. Nationalist Afrikanerdom is on the march to its final destiny. This is the last lap. Let me pause there. This thing about Verwoerd being tireless, dedicated, and determined, when we get to the last video in the series where we look at his career properly by way of his private secretary, then you will see the determination and energy of this man. This man is unbelievable. Probably in the entire history of South Africa, there was never a man of more energy than Verwoerd. He set out with absolute determination and full energy to implement apartheid, racial segregation, and see to it that things work out for the whites. He did this tirelessly and he risked his life selflessly. Absolutely fantastic man. So let's continue. An aloof academic man, Dr. Verwoerd has compensated for his lack of ability to rouse passions by practicing the art of mass psychology. As the fledgling professor of applied psychology at Stellenbosch University, he contributed a paper to the Essay Journal of Science, 1928, on the psychology of newspaper advertisements. He gave as an example an advertisement for a stomach medicine. It showed a dog with a child gripped firmly in its jaws, standing sturdily in the middle of a rushing stream. The caption read, "Saved." By the same technique, the simple association of ideas, Dr. Verwoerd has persuaded Afrikanerdom, presumably, that he is its savior. Let me just pause there and just say, look, any good leader has got some kind of knowledge of psychology, whether he picks it up or whatever. Even a guy like Trump has got some basic understanding of people. I have no doubt that any good leader has an understanding of communicating with people. It's a must. So all this seems to be yet more bitterness from an enemy. Remember, this whole article is written by an enemy, an Englishman, so he's trying to stick his knife into Verwoerd at every twist and turn. But let's continue. With the crude but effective art of the mass propagandist, he has almost succeeded in convincing Afrikaners, and perhaps others too, that to criticize him is tantamount to heresy. Minutes after the result of the leadership ballot had been announced to the caucus, he was staking his claim to divine rule. I believe that the will of God was revealed in the ballot. 2 days later, in a national broadcast, he repeated, in accordance with his will, it was determined who should assume the leadership of the government in this new period of the life of the people of South Africa. Again and again, Dr. Verwoerd has returned to this theme and to two or three other selected themes, namely that he is democratic, that the unity of the Nationalist Party is paramount, unity and criticism of the new Prime Minister being mutually exclusive, and that a new era has begun. Skillfully and speedily, Dr. Verwoerd has conveyed to nationalist Afrikaners that they swim or sink with him. In these circumstances, the chances of a revolt against his leadership, the opposition's last dream, are indeed remote. Even the white opposition in South Africa, always ready to avoid the realities of life, was obliged to accept the implications of Dr. Verwoerd's election. The Johannesburg Star commented shrewdly, in an important sense, Dr. Verwoerd's election might be called the triumph of a lost cause. If there is any meaning in this selection above, so stalwart a Republican as Mr. Swart, or so skillful a politician as Dr. Dongers, it can only be that Dr. Verwoerd stands for the ultimate solution of South Africa's race problem through separation. It is astonishing that there are still enough nationalists who believe that such a solution is possible that they have voluntarily submitted to the yoke that Dr. Verwoerd will assuredly place upon them. The new Prime Minister embodies the great illusion. His progress will be strewn with discarded liberties of white men as well as black, but it is a foregone conclusion that it will get no nearer the goal, the Cape Times characteristically forthright declared. Dr. Verwoerd is dedicated to a fantastic and fanatical conception of apartheid, to a lunatic attempt to unscramble the South African racial omelette at any cost in human privation and dignity, unless his wider powers and direct responsibility change him. Dr. Verwoerd's appointment may mark the transition in South Africa from an easygoing, elastic, more or less democratic parliamentarianism to a rigid regimentation backed by a tyrannical party machine on the lines of the regimes which brought some European countries to ruin. See Shades of Fascism and Nazism. If this happens, Dr. Verwoerd will wreck the Nationalist Party. The danger is that the country will be wrecked first. These are all liberals whining and crying and carrying on and predicting the end of the line and failure and all that. But let's continue and listen to all the liberal crap. Because the fact of the matter was that apartheid became stronger and stronger, and South Africa became a freaking military power and economic power. The greatest power in all of Africa. Probably only Egypt at a point being close in power to that of South Africa. Some more liberal whining and crying. The Cape Argus observed aptly that South Africa sets out on this Dr. Verwoerd's road with alarm bells sounding and warning signals flashing. Just more liberal Jewish claptrap. Ah, everything's going to fall apart. As for Dr. Favurt himself, he had endorsed these predictions in advance. In an article in the Nationalist Sunday newspaper, Dagbreek in Sondagnuus, that's Afrikaans for daybreak and Sunday news, written just before the fateful caucus meeting to elect a new leader. In the article, he stated the requirements for an Afrikaner leader. Sincere conviction and firm action command the confidence and esteem of friends and foe, while weak leadership divides and alienates. Afrikaner leader is never a tyrant, never dishonest, self-centered, a power-greedy ruler. Tyrant, self-centered, power-greedy. At that precise moment, Dr. Favut's extremist supporters were campaigning vigorously for a strong man as a leader. The Nationalist Party, they said, could not afford a weak interim leader like the aging Mr. Swart. As yet, I have said nothing about Dr. Favut's most important achievements as the architect of apartheid, or as one of his MPs phrased it so picturesquely as, quotes, the greatest Induna of all times. Now, let me just tell you, in Africa, an Induna is a leader. So, so this guy is saying that Favurt is going to be the greatest Induna, basically leader, Führer, of all times. Just borrowing from some Africanisms. Whites used to do that, and we should stop doing that. We should rather borrow from our Europeanisms. So it should have been said, the greatest Führer of all times. Let's continue. What, in fact, are the achievements of this chubby-faced man who summons vast indabas? An indaba is also another one of these African things. It means a meeting. An indaba is a meeting. Or assemblies of Africans, and speaks in curious, half-forgotten parables, trying to revive an age and a spirit that are passing away, who speaks no African language but prides himself on an understanding of the native mind. Let me just pause there. Don't listen to that liberal claptrap, okay? Because he can't speak their language, he doesn't understand them. He knows European science. That's more than adequate for the task, I assure you. Let's continue. Who received, allegedly, a congratulatory message on his election as Prime Minister from the African residents of Pokwani village, reading, the white bull's herd is lowing at the kraal. Even the calves are looking for him. Please throw out a mouthful of feed to quiet their hearts. So this is just black stuff, where they are referring to him as a white bull. Let's continue. Half of the pages of Africa South, since the inception of the journal, have been given over to discussion of Favurt's apartheid, and yet only half the story has been told. For 8 years since he became Minister of Native Affairs, I think it's in 1950, there are some errors on this page where some letters and numbers can't be read properly. So I think this is 1950, I think. Since he became Minister of Native Affairs in 1950, Dr. Favut has literally not stopped talking. But words, like alcohol with other men, are his compulsion, theories, words and schemes, poured in dull rivers from his tongue and pen to sail his paper argosies of dreams. Statistics, numbers, races fill his vision, ransacked from Europe, Africa, and Asia, and patched together with a schooled precision, to form a bold, methodical fantasia, his 100-year design, his master plan, to keep the nets, the masters, and their clan. Seems somebody wrote some kind of derogatory poem about him. It's called Judgment Day or something. All these whining, crying baby liberals, all whining and bitching. Meanwhile, these stronger men went on to do great things and to save white rule and the whites for decades to come. Where does one begin with this man who, after becoming prime minister, boasted that instead of mellowing, he would remain a devil? So, see, Favut seems to have had no problem describing himself as a bad boy. He is not out to placate his enemies. He carries on, and in that he was true to himself, like a true white leader. So it continues, his speeches teem with remarks like this one. It is in no way a pleasant duty to have people, even though they are natives, imprisoned. He has closed the doors of more schools and opened the doors of more jails than any other South African in history. Once, surprisingly, he bowed to public opinion. He abandoned, temporarily, a scheme to establish a labor camp. Oh God, a concentration camp, in fact, for African political offenders. Well, there you have it. There you have it. Favut was going to establish a labor camp, concentration camp for black political offenders. All kinds of shades of Nazi thinking. Continued, the policy of the department has always been to scatter rather than to concentrate deportees. One advantage of his verbosity is that ultimately he blurts out the truth. When he introduced the Bantu Authorities Act, he presented it solicitously as a plan to revive the wilting flower of tribalism. Then he let slip, the tribal authority is the natural ally of the government against such rebellious movements like the Mau Mau. He's basically talking of the communists who are going to be trying to overthrow the system. It was the chiefs with their authorities who sided with the forces of law and order and who assisted European authority. We are dealing with the restoration of a natural native democracy. I can't pronounce this word here. It's something like Sekukuna land in flames, with chiefs and headmen banned and banished, as they refused to accept the total capitulation prescribed for them in the fake Bantu authorities system. This was Favut's simple view. Bantu education is another example. Let me just pause there a little bit. This thing of black chiefs being the friends of white rule, this was true elsewhere in Africa and true in Rhodesia too. The black chiefs were on the side of the whites, and it took quite some time for these communist insurgents and these political upstarts funded by the Soviet Union and China and liberals, it took quite some time for them to gain a foothold on the blacks. And the chiefs were much more sedate. They weren't rebellious. Not that I care too much, but I'm just stating a few facts about how things really worked. So let's continue. Bantu education is another example. I believe that racial relations will be improved when Bantu education is handled in the manner proposed by us. Racial relations cannot improve if the result of native education is the creation of a frustrated people who, as a result of the education they receive, have expectations in life which circumstances in South Africa do not allow to be fulfilled. When it creates people who are trained for professions not open to them, good racial relations cannot exist when the education is given under the supervision of people who believe in a policy of equality. Such a person will, by the very nature of education he gives, both as regards the content of the education and the spirit, create expectations in the mind of the Bantu which clash with the possibilities in his country. It is therefore necessary that native education should be controlled in such a way that it should be in accord with the policy of the state. Let me just pause there. Basically, all he's saying is that if you give the blacks an education, let's say a higher education equal to that of whites, that those blacks will then naturally want to have those tasks and those jobs. But his purpose is that he wants these blacks to basically stay at the lower levels, and he's not going to open up all of the economy for these blacks, so he's educating them in accordance with what they're going to get. This takes us back to the Hindus and the Aryans in India. The Aryans who invented Hinduism had a better solution to their grand apartheid. Hinduism, which is the original apartheid, it's a religion, but Hinduism basically, which was a religion created by the whites, the Aryans who conquered the Indians of India. And the way that the Hindus got around it was that the warriors, the whites, who were the warriors and the priests, were at the top of the system, and then they created this caste system, which exists in India to this day. And this caste system was the original apartheid. And basically it taught people that the best system for the country is a system where everybody stays in their own class. And they created a religion around this. And I must tell you that I think that that is the most sophisticated freaking answer to apartheid that you could possibly get. I mentioned this when I did that lecture of mine, The 50 Years of Race War in Southern Africa. I mentioned this point. But it's something I'll return to later when we talk about the Aryans and so forth. But the Aryans had apartheid in India for 600 years before they interbred with the non-whites and then themselves disappeared. But I thought that the religion idea was a stroke of genius on the part of the Aryans, and sadly, the South Africans didn't seem to have studied that. Maybe the solution would have been a religion. And you create a religion and you tell the blacks, listen, God wants you to be in this position. You know, they could have done that kind of thing. But you see, the thing about whites also in modern times is that we are honest. We are honest and we just openly state certain things and that's that. And in his case anyway, he wants the non-whites to rule themselves. You know, if the non-whites want to be doctors and scientists and engineers, they must go and create their own country and go and create those positions themselves. But what you'll find with apartheid and all white civilization is that everybody else wants in on what the white man has actually created for himself. So the white man creates all the things he wants for himself. Then everybody else sees, oh, this is good. And then everybody else wants in on the white man's action. And that really is the story of what happens. One day we will discuss why did apartheid fail. And the real reason why apartheid failed may shock you. I've sat and thought about this long and hard. And it's very much along those lines that you see there, where I'm telling you, everybody wants in on the action of the white man. Now, in America, the elite are just drawing everybody in. Yeah, you can all come in, be a part of this wonderful thing. You'll see the problems that come out of that. One day, people will be dusting off apartheid, and they'll say, man, those whites were really wise in their day. That's how history goes. People make enormous errors. It buggers things up for decades. And later somebody says, good God, did you see those other white people? They were doing the right thing. Look at them. They were way ahead of their time. You'll see the same thing true for Hitler. People will look back and say Hitler was hundreds of years ahead of his time. Hundreds of years ahead of his time. So anyway, that's what Verwoerd is saying. Verwoerd has no desire to promote the non-whites, has no desire to promote the blacks. So he's simply saying, in this state, when we're the boss, this is what you're allowed to do, that's what I'm going to teach you to do, and that's that. I'm not going to give you expectations you don't need. Now, interestingly enough, getting a little bit off the topic here, but the Anglo-American Jewish way of telling all these non-whites how freaking great they are, that's also why these blacks are leaving Africa. Because in Africa, things are not working, but they say, oh, look at Britain, look at Europe, look at America. I can go there and I can be great things over there across the border on another continent run by whites. Meanwhile, just a few decades ago, these blacks were fighting and protesting and wanting self-rule. They've been whining and crying and agitating. Oh, we want self-rule. We also want a country of our own. We want our own thing. Later when I tell you about Rhodesia, we can talk about the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland and how that broke up. And that was a perfect example where blacks were turning around. Oh, no, we don't want to be part of the Federation. We don't want to be under white rule that's helping us. No, no, we want our own path. We want out of this thing right now. We want black rule immediately. And so they got black rule immediately, and their countries started collapsing immediately too. These are the kinds of things that happen. And you go and you look back and you see, now they want to be citizens of Europe and America, but just 50 years ago they wanted to have their own black country. So now you've got all these millions and millions of blacks fleeing Africa. But just go back and look at the record, and you'll find that 60 years ago, all of them, oh, no, no, we want self-rule, we want nationalism, we want our own countries, white man must get out, we must be the presidents. And now, 60 years later, they're all freaking jumping across the border, jumping on ships, planes to get the fuck out of Africa. And that should show you these people don't know what they want. They have got all kinds of visions and ideas, and they want this and they want that. And then they see, oh no, you see, the grass is greener on the other side. On the other side of the fence where the white man's living, I got to move there. That's where I got to go. The grass is greener there. That is the basic psychology of all these people. And then when they get there, they start changing it to being the way it was in the place that they came from. I'm telling you, that is history. You're going to see it happening in America. You'll see the mess that comes to America. Let me tell you, the wisdom of the white man and the wisdom of the white racial man, whether he's Hitler or whether he's the whites of Southern Africa, the wisdom of the white man will still stand strong and firm in future history when people look back on these times and they have to look sadly and say, man, not only were these whites right, but they were crushed and destroyed even though they were right. And in the case of Favort, he got killed even though he was right. He was killed probably for being right. So let's just finish this little piece from 1959. When one writes about Dr. Favort, one is afflicted with his verbosity. The subject of apartheid is never-ending, the misery interminable, that it will end in catastrophe now seems certain. Dr. Favort himself has prophesied the future. So this is what Favort says. It is easy to sit back. I have decided, even at the risk of becoming unpopular, or even if I made mistakes, to attempt to find a solution. It is better to have fought and lost than never to have fought at all. And that is the end of the article. This was published in March 1959. So let me repeat that lovely quote from Favort. I think that is an excellent quote. It says, it is easy to sit back, and I have decided, even at the risk of becoming unpopular, or even if I made mistakes, to attempt to find a solution. It is better to have fought and lost than never to have fought at all. It is better to have fought and lost than never to have fought at all. I must tell you, I personally, in my studies of history, I have come to exactly that conclusion. It is better to fight and lose than never to have fought at all. Definitely. You must stand up for what you believe in. Definitely. So that is the end of that nasty article about Favort. But the purpose of that was so that you could see what he was saying about the Jews, what he was doing just to give you some insight into him, but especially on the topic of the Jews. And you can see the Jews hated him. They hated him because he was looking at what they were doing and he didn't like it. And he wanted to see to it that the whites, especially the Afrikaans speakers, get a piece of the economy and get access to high-level jobs. And you can see the man is a racialist. He's shoving the blacks to one side. He gives them enough to sort of keep them going on the one side. But he's really out to protect the whites at all costs. And this man was the greatest leader in the history of South Africa. In the hundreds of years of white presence in South Africa, this guy was the greatest. What I'm going to do now is add in a separate video based on a recording that I did in January 2020. In January 2020, I had the opportunity to go and attend a book launch where a very important communist Jew who'd been very high up in parliament in South Africa, Ronnie Kasrils, spoke. And I actually used the opportunity to ask Kasrils face to face why it was that the Jews detested Verwoerd. Why did they detest Verwoerd and why did they like Mandela? And he replied to me and he spoke at length. And I recorded it. So that video will now follow here because it's relevant. You'll hear him talk about Verwoerd. You'll hear him talk about Verwoerd actually sounding like a kindly old uncle or old professor, but actually being a madman. The Jews hate Verwoerd. And here you'll hear it out of the mouth of yet another Jew. Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. What you're about to hear is a recording that I did on 25th of January 2020. And the photos that you see are photos that I took of Ronnie Kasrils. Who is Ronnie Kasrils? Ronnie Kasrils is one of the top Jewish communists in the time of the war between the blacks and the whites. This guy was a very senior member of the South African Communist Party. This is your classic Jewish communist, actually. This is exactly the kind of person that Adolf Hitler and the Nazis fought against, Jewish communism, or as they called it, Jewish Bolshevism. In fact, in the days when I had my Jewish friend, I actually raised the issue of Ronnie Kasrils, this very guy, whom you see the photo of, which I took on the 25th of January, I actually raised the issue of this guy, is this guy a Jewish communist? There was a time about 10 or so years ago when I spoke to my Jewish friend one day and I said to him, you know, didn't Adolf Hitler say something about Jews and communism? Jews being communists or involved in communism? And my Jewish friend went to great lengths over the next week to tell me that Ronnie Kasrils is not Jewish. However, as you will discover in my recordings of the 25th of January, You will hear out of the mouth of Ronnie Caserals himself, as well as the Jews who were present at the meeting, you will hear them all talking about being Jews and Jewish. Yet my friend had gone to great lengths to tell me, no, Ronnie Caserals, no, he's not Jewish. No, he's not Jewish. And his reasoning, I'll get back to the story, but his reasoning is, well, you see, he's an atheist, therefore he cannot be a Jew. And that is the line he took back then. But he's a Jew. His parents are Jewish. His grandparents are Jewish. He grew up in a Jewish community. He identifies with Jews. He's got family in Israel. And there he is, welcomed by the Jewish community. And they're all talking about we Jews. And they're also talking about we whites. So just a bit of background about this recording. The day before this, on the 24th of January, one of my very loyal supporters, a lady, sent me a message late in the evening. It was a Friday evening. She said to me, "Jan, tomorrow Ronnie Caserals is going to be at a book launch, and it's very close to where you live, and you can go there, and I'll give you the address." And I said, "Yeah, sure." And the more I began to think about it, the more I began to think this might be a really good idea. And I went there, and when I was there, I asked the person hosting this talk, I asked if I could take photos. And I was told, "Yes, you can go ahead." So I took photos, and I recorded the entire talk. And I got a chance to ask Ronnie Caserals a question. This is actually the second time in my life that I've had a chance to talk to this Jewish communist. The last time was sometime in the period 1993 to 1995. He doesn't know about the time that I spoke to him before. But I can show you some of the stuff that I got as a direct result of my discussion with him. And one of the things that I got as a result of my discussion with him was his book, Armed and Dangerous, which had just come out, and he was boasting about it. But he also told me where to get other communist literature, which is what I was really after at the time. I must have had a 20-minute discussion with him back then. I phoned up the Communist Party headquarters in Johannesburg, and I said to them, "Listen, I'm a budding communist. I'm very, very interested in communism. I want to learn as much as I can about communism." The reason I said that was because I was looking for communist literature. I had heard that the communists, the South African Communist Party, has got a journal. And the journal is called The African Communist. And I wanted to get my hands on that journal, because in the Communist Party journal, I wanted to see what these scum-sucking pigs have in store for us whites in South Africa. So one day I hit on the idea, let me phone the Communist Party, and back then we didn't have cell phones, we just had landlines. Let me phone the Communist Party and see if I can find out how do I subscribe to or get copies of The African Communist. Well, to my utter amazement, when I phoned them, they said, "Yeah, we'll put you through to someone." And they put me straight through to Ronnie Caserals. He and I had a 20-minute discussion. I kid you not. The two of us had a long 20-minute discussion. And I was saying to him, "I'm so interested in communism. Where can I get literature?" And he said to me, "Well, what you do is you go into Johannesburg and you go there, and in there at on that street corner, you'll find that little shop and you'll find all our literature there." And I went there, and in that little shop, it was filled with communist literature from all over the world. I'd never known that there were so many communist publications in the world. My jaw just about hit the floor. There was communist magazines and journals from all across the world, Europe, you name it. And it is there that I went and I got copies of The African Communist. And I managed to get a couple of copies over a period of time because I wanted to read what have these people got in store for us. And I still have those very journals that I got back then. I still have them in my possession. But anyway, here was the chance to talk to him face to face. And I went with my friend and we listened to his talk and the question and answer session about his latest book, his third book. And I was looking for an opportunity to try and ask him a question. And they didn't have much of a question and answer session, but I managed to get the first real question in. And I'd thought hard about how I'm going to phrase this thing in the hope that I can get as much information out of him as possible. And I gave him a story, and he actually went on and he started talking quite a lot. And he actually said a whole bunch of interesting things, really interesting stuff. And I did my utmost to be friendly and to try to encourage him more and to see if I could possibly get in a second question. But somebody else came and asked another question and then they cut the rest of it short. But I did get quite a good chunk of time where he spoke and he answered my question. What you are actually going to listen to now is the question and answer session where I managed to get in and I asked Ronnie Casserolls a question. I tried to make the question friendly. Because in the atmosphere that had been created earlier, they were trying to stay out of politics. Most of the attendees were either Jews and there were some English-speaking whites. So it was Jews and your typical liberal, weak, sheep-like South African English speaker. Sheep-like and fitting in with Jews. So these people were not critics or enemies of Casserolls. And Casserolls felt at home. And the whole thing was, like I say, mostly Jews, but also these English speakers and a couple of Afrikaans people here and there. But this is what the audience was like. And they were quite old. There were very few young people there, if any. And they had already said they're not going to discuss Zionism, but then they said, well, we might discuss Zionism, because now apparently there's a debate between the Jews, because Casserolls is anti-Zionist. And this is an example of the Jews sort of arguing among themselves, but don't get your hopes up, okay? Don't get your hopes up. Don't imagine that these Jews are going to go and slit each other's throats. That's not going to happen. They sit and they argue, but it's small arguments. It's like when the blacks argue with each other. In fact, the blacks are more violent when they argue with each other. But in this question and answer session, I didn't want to come across as somebody as the enemy. So I was trying to get a sense of stuff and try and get information out of him. My real key interest was in Dr. Verwoerd. And Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd was Dutch and he was the greatest leader South Africa had ever had in its entire history. And what most people don't know is that this guy was a closet National Socialist. He was a Nazi. So if you want a guy who was a true Nazi, who ruled a country after Adolf Hitler, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd of South Africa is the prime candidate. And just like George Lincoln Rockwell, Jews hated him to such a degree that there were two attempts on his life and the second one succeeded. We're going to come back to the topic of the Jewish role in the killing of Verwoerd. Verwoerd was hated by the Jews. And the hatred is downplayed. People don't really realize it in modern times. And this guy was the greatest white leader in the history of South Africa. This man did more things for South Africa than you can believe. So you will always hear the Jews and everybody talking about Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, the architect of apartheid. But keep in mind, Verwoerd was born in Holland. He also did some schooling in Rhodesia, but he lived in South Africa for most of his life, and he became the Prime Minister of South Africa. And this man was extremely brilliant. He was the greatest leader this country has ever seen. The greatest things that ever happened in South Africa and that happened for whites happened under his rule. So remember, the greatest leader in the history of South Africa was a Dutch Nazi who identified and was totally part and parcel of the Afrikaners, the Boerer. I decided, therefore, to ask an open-ended question on the basis that I might only get one shot at asking him something. So I tried to sort of sneak in and get my question in. And when he was answering, I was smiling and I was going like, wow, wow, and encouraging him and looking for an opportunity to try and get in a second question. And in the end, about the only thing I managed to say was that, yes, I've got your book, Armed and Dangerous. But they then maneuvered this thing, and the next thing was somebody else came in, and then they got it away from this topic. But I did manage to get quite a lot out of him, and you'll see how he answered my question. So I tried to get a question on Verwoerd and Mandela, and in his reply, he actually gives away a lot of stuff. In his reply, he tells us how Verwoerd was hated. But he doesn't say Jews hated Verwoerd. He claims that everybody hated Verwoerd. And then he goes on to say that the mass media was constantly saying, Verwoerd must go, Verwoerd must go. But it's actually the English mass media that was saying that. And it was as a result of that that he was then shot. Now, this thing of Verwoerd must go, Verwoerd must go, those of you who know more about Jews, you'll know that it's not the English mass media, it's the Jewish mass media. Jews are pushing the agenda here. Jews are the ones creating this Verwoerd must go, Verwoerd must go. And there are even some newspaper headlines from the past that you can read that are on the internet which show, you know, Verwoerd must go, Verwoerd must go. So he talks about Verwoerd, and then watch how he says, well, you know, Verwoerd was maybe decent, but, you know, he was absolutely insane. Eventually, the hatred, the sheer hatred for Verwoerd comes out in his own mouth. And then he goes on and he starts talking about Nelson Mandela and a black chief called Luthuli. And he also actually mentions, by the way, that he thinks Luthuli was a greater leader than Mandela, and that Luthuli died mysteriously by falling in front of a train. And he thinks that somebody pushed him. So I'm not sure if he's saying that the whites had an agent who pushed Luthuli in front of the train, or whether blacks among themselves had an agent who pushed Luthuli under the train. But somebody killed him, and he alludes to this very strongly. But then listen carefully to his glowing accounts of Nelson Mandela. Every Jew that I've ever met who's actually met Mandela talks like Casrils. In fact, the way that Casrils speaks in this entire session is very similar to the way my Jewish friend used to talk to me. Similar tone of voice, similar kind of Jewish humor. You won't see it in here, but when you listen to the entire discussion, you'll hear him going off down his little Jewish path, and he starts giving you his little Jewish funny story. My Jewish friend used to talk exactly like that. Similar tone of voice, similar way, very similar. And he was an older, much more educated Jew. So he wasn't just any Jew. He was pretty good. He knew history. He knew politics. And it'll give you a sense of the kinds of discussions that I had with my Jewish friend before I kicked him out of my life. Now, my Jewish friend also told me one day, he said, I've met Nelson Mandela in person. And I was like, really? And then he started talking about Mandela, and he was like, you'd think he'd met God himself. Oh, so great a leader, so awe-inspiring, blah, blah, blah. There was another time I met a half-Jew, and this half-Jew had to do with a security company. And I met the half-Jew and got to know him quite well. I didn't know he was a half-Jew, but much later he told me he was a half-Jew, and he cut off contact with me the moment he realized that I was anti-Jewish. So initially I went and dealt with him on the basis of security in our area. And then as we got to know each other, that's where one thing led to another. And eventually he discovered I'm right wing and he discovers I detest Jews. Then he kicked me out of his circle and he immediately hooked up with Jews, but that didn't work out so well for him. In the end, he lost his position anyway. But the point is that this half Jew that I met, he also told me a story about how he'd met Nelson Mandela. And it was exactly the same as what you're going to hear Kazril saying. Starts, oh, he's so awe-inspiring, he's so incredible, they've got such intellect, oh, blah, 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 blah. You'd think he's just met God himself. So listen to this. Listen to him talking about Favut. And then listen to the things he says, the information available about Favut. And then you'll start finding how, you'll see how he starts trying to say that, well, you know, Favut might have seemed nice, but he was really insane. You know, he's starting that Hitler type attack on Favut. He was nice, but he was really insane. And, you know, really deep down, blah, blah, blah. And then then watch when he switches over to Mandela. And then it's like, oh, he's so awe-inspiring. He's so incredible. And whites in South Africa, the mystery for the whites of South Africa is that whites in South Africa do not know. They do not know that the Jews hate their guts, and the Jews have got their outlets in the mass media around the world. And one of the mysteries for the whites of South Africa has always been, how come this fucking Nelson Mandela fucking terrorist, how come this Nelson Mandela terrorist, why is he like a god? Why is he treated like a god around the world? There's even like an international Nelson Mandela Day. Like international. Where does that come from? Well, I'll bet you it all comes from Jews. And these whites in South Africa, especially the Afrikaans speakers, they don't know why it is that this fucking enemy fucking terrorist has got such good publicity all around the world. They just can't understand. You know, is the world insane? You know, doesn't the world realize he was a terrorist, a murderer, a communist terrorist? He plotted the deaths of people. He advocated killing of people. He was responsible for bombings. Why isn't anybody seeing that he's an evil piece of shit? Well, the answer, as you will discover more and more, is Jews. It's Jews, and I will show you more about on this same topic. But here, as a starter, is Ronnie Kazrils. And watch Ronnie Kazrils talking about Favut and talking about Mandela, because those were the two questions I asked about him. And you'll see how he talks about Favut and how he eventually gets into, you can see he absolutely hates Favut. And he starts saying, well, you know, he has to be insane and so forth. Just like they say about Hitler, you know, oh, Hitler, he was a madman, he was crazy, blah, blah, blah. Just listen to Ronnie Kazrils go into exactly the same thing over Favut. And then he blossoms out into, oh, Mandela, so fantastic. So then look at the way he talks, and then go and ask yourself, why is it that the mass media of the English-speaking world is saying apartheid bad, Hendrik Verwoerd wrong, evil apartheid, and good Nelson Mandela? The mass media of the entire world is echoing what the Jews think. The Jews set the cultural tone for the entire Western civilization. Jews set the tone for everything. Jews control people's minds. Jews see to it that their viewpoints become your viewpoints. That's what Jews do. And it should be very clear in this discussion, right out of his own mouth, you watch how he handles the answering of this question. And all the time I was like, wow, 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 and hoping to get in a second question. But then somebody cut me off, and then they did a little question, and then they terminated the thing. They said they'd run out of time and all that. But I was really pleased with what he said, because in there, he starts telling you other stuff. He gives some additional information. The first guy who went and shot Hendrik Verwoerd was a guy called Pratt. And Pratt seems to be some kind of Englishman. He doesn't seem to be Jewish, but he seems to be an Englishman, a wealthy Englishman, very liberal, very under the influence of Jews. And this Englishman walks up to Verwoerd and blows him away. He fires straight into his face. It is almost a miracle that Verwoerd survived that. He was very, very lucky. And I must tell you, South Africa's first-class science and medicine of those days comes through. Verwoerd could have been as dead as a doornail. It was a very close-run thing. I will show you later the direct Jewish link, between Pratt and Pratt shooting Verwoerd. But in here, you will hear him talking about Pratt. You'll hear him talking about him having a farm where blacks can go to. You'll hear him talking about being a wealthy businessman with a factory. And you'll hear that I think his father was a friend of Pratt. So you will see some of the Jewish links, and Pratt being well known and well respected by these Jews, you'll see that coming out right here in this thing. And to me, this is unique. I've not heard this kind of testimony or seen any testimony like this anywhere else. I also did a bit of noise reduction and sort of volume fixing so that the sounds are much clearer. So there's a little bit of tin, but otherwise it's a lot clearer. And you should be able to hear very clearly everything he says. Here is the question and answer session.
Discovering when his films were made. So the Google, it took me a minute, 2 minutes, and I had it. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Ronnie? Bill? Mom? You heard it?
May I ask some questions? I'd like to ask a little bit about the early days of your time in the ANC. The sort of rough times, because I think you spoke about the recreation of, or the rebuilding of the ANC. I have two kinds of things I'd like to ask. The one is, how important was Nelson Mandela as a figure that stands up against the system? And how was Verwoerd? Was he like a nightmare kind of a person who's busy just crushing things and smashing things down? How did you guys see those two people?
So I'm going to start with Verwoerd, and then I come to Mandela, who I actually knew. So in those days, there was no television, and you had South African, Nuvitone News, South African one, in the cinemas, and that was the only time you might see Jan Smuts or Verwoerd, or unless you went to the rugby Springboks and so on, and you kind of tried to gauge what they were like fleetingly from a newsreel. Otherwise, it was photographs in the newspaper. And then it depended on how people spoke. So the English-speaking press had a campaign going at this stage leading to David Pratt shooting Verwoerd at the Rand show. And my father worked for David Pratt's family, by the way.
Oh, they wow. Had
a downtown Dorfenty sweet factory. And the Pratts were very nice people. My father told me, you know, when all this happened, the only family in the Magaliesberg with a huge farm, with a farm, and that's where David Pratt was. His brother Stuart was my father's boss at Crispy's Candy. And my father told us that the Pratts allowed anybody of any race to picnic on their farmlands. So non-white people who had scant place to go when they wanted a picnic, they all used to home in on their farm. But why did Pratt, who was not very political except English speaker, so, you know, the apartheid aspect, they might have voted United Party, not very, very militant or anything, but Verwoerd was so identified with what was going wrong in the country and with apartheid as the architect that the English-speaking press were running a campaign, Verwoerd must go. And it was almost daily in the Sunday papers, banner headlines, Verwoerd must go, you know. And this is what got through to David Pratt, clearly turned his mind in that kind of climate. It's only in latter years that with Google and so on, you can actually check Verwoerd and his speeches at the time and interviews with him. And I'd heard this about Verwoerd, that he was an avuncular character. And he would discuss apartheid policy in very reasonable ways, and we're not against the black man, but we're different, the races are different, we don't want to take advantage of people, and therefore apartheid is simply to keep people in their own categories so that there's peace and progress. And the black person, the Khoza in his category, and the Zulu in his, and the coloured in theirs, they must have their own space, because God did not want people to mix. This is what causes trouble. And he literally speaks this way. It's like a mad professor who's totally carried away with an absolute evil doctrine, the result of which is this incredible suffering of people. And in those days, one didn't see this aspect of Verwoerd, and it doesn't mean he wasn't evil, but he was just known as this is the architect of apartheid and totally hated and loathed, except by those who, in their view, we must keep totally apart. Now, this doesn't go against Jews having their own particular community, or Irish, or 1820 settlers, or, you know, or the Scots, or whatever. But it's where you come together for your own particular culture without denying others and equality and justice and so on. And the whole apartheid thing puts into actual legal effect the group areas of act, the dispossession of land, and, you know, that whole gory detail. So he was an absolutely horrendous character who was responsible. But the, in personality terms, there were far worse guys who were absolutely guttural and vicious, whereas Favut never raised his voice. He never screamed and shouted and banged tables and threatened people. But, you know, he was obviously a guy that people would have, if they knew him, have a bit of second doubt. And, you know, but he's a very kindly, uncle-y, avuncular figure. Nelson Mandela, by the time I become aware of him, is the 1959, the treason trial, which is 56, and I'm kind of in the trick. So one's aware that, you know, without any personal knowledge or detail about people like Chief Albert Luthuli, about Mandela and the others, and you don't have any idea of what they actually stand for, that they are standing for a non-racist South Africa in which we'll live together and in a democracy and so on. The whites don't have any knowledge of that. Unless you have a teacher like Teddy Gordon who gives me or directs me to read a book by Trevor Huddleston, North Field of Comfort, which is a brilliant book about what apartheid is. So, you know, when you see photos of a Mandela or even a Chief Luthuli or a Trevor Huddleston, you think that these guys are, if they black, are like racist and wanting, like people would think today to some degree, you know, through the years, that the word terrorism wasn't in the vocabulary at that time. But, you know, these are the leaders of the natives who will kill all of us whites. And anything absolutely far from that. By the time I become politically aware and joined, I then have recourse to speeches, pamphlets, even some books were available about the ANC and about Mandela or Luthuli, and you then become really very, very impressed. When you start actually meeting these people, then you are blown away, because these are people with incredible intellect. And, you know, you've grown up as a white, and no matter how liberal you might be, the blacks, you know, are people in menial service who don't have a good English. And here you're suddenly meeting with black guys who have an English language and vocabulary far better than one's own, and who are extremely kind people, serious, discuss things, give their time if there's the opportunity to answer questions, because we would then meet as a small group of whites who I was attracted to, these house meetings, like a meeting like this, but it would be illegal, so we couldn't all leave our cars the way we have today, and yet it would be at night, and you'd come in, it wouldn't be as big as this, but maybe a dozen people, and there would be somebody like a Mandela, who's there to actually tell this group who are seriously interested, what does the ANC stand for? So I met Mandela a little later. I'd met a few others beforehand who were leaders. And then I met Mandela when I joined in Kanto Rusizwe. And he came to meet the command group in Durban to brief us and to guide us and to discuss MK. And I write about that in my first memoir, which is Armed and Dangerous.
Which I have.
So, you know, you can try and find that.
Yeah.
But very, very impressive. And that's why, sorry, that's why you've had such respect accorded, not to justice. Mandela's not the flash in the pan. This Chief Albert John Luthuli, I would rate the most impressive, more than Mandela.
Oh, wow.
You know, you've heard the name. He was the president of the ANC, and I think they killed him in about 1966. Yeah. And there's a case that his family are bringing now, because he was a very large, wonderful guy, a bit like Paul Robeson, if anyone knows that great African-American singer. And he was a great singer. I was in meetings with the two lead down in the sugarcane fields of Natal, usually at an Indian farm. And there'd be about 50, 60 people from around South Africa. Mandela was out of the country at that time. And the Thule was like Martin Luther King, even more imposing, because the Thule was like, you know, a Muhammad Ali. He, you know, that kind of, well, Mandela as well, you know, this big build, and, but he had more girth to him. And a really kind, loving, a very Christian man. Without, you know, not a Desmond Tutu type, but he was very Christian and absolutely incredible man. So it was said that a railway locomotive knocked him down near his home in Grafton, where he was restricted, banished to. And there's a very big doubt about whether he wasn't pushed into that trap.
Assassination, anyway. Maybe.
Sorry,
going back to your schoolboy days.
Yes.
You wrote about being at school with Gary Player.
Yes.
Just a few points about what Kasrul said. He talks about the incredible suffering of the blacks under apartheid. That is vastly overstated. The blacks of South Africa had the highest standard of living of any blacks in Africa. However, what actually transpires is that you will see that it's actually probably the Jews who guided Mandela. And there are statements that Mandela made where he basically indicates that the blacks need to share in the wealth of South Africa. So it's not about the blacks getting an amount of money that is enough to survive on. It is that the blacks want in on the higher standards of living that exist in South Africa. So these blacks of South Africa, to try and get it in the right context, these blacks of South Africa are not on the edge of starvation. These blacks of South Africa are actually trying to get a chunk of the pie that is South Africa. And South Africa is doing very, very well. And the standards are extremely high. It has very high standards for the whites. Whites are doing exceptionally well. So you must never think about the blacks of South Africa as, oh God, these people are about to starve to death and they're going to drop dead next week. Never at any time in their history were they in such a situation under white rule. They are not in the same situation as blacks further north in Africa who are dying from starvation and hunger. These blacks have got the best standard of living of the blacks in Africa. What you are getting, though, is a lot of Jewish propaganda and black propaganda, where what they're trying to do is they're really trying to play up the differences in standard of living between the blacks and the whites. That's the real game here. So they're not on the edge of death. It's just that they want a bigger chunk of the pie. And he says something about apartheid not actually being against the Jews, and it would allow the Jews and the Irish and others to have their own communities. From my own observations of the ideas that they had about apartheid, the whites who created apartheid, just some other pointers. The original architects of apartheid, many of them were academics, intellectuals, university professors. Verwoerd himself had been a professor at a university. These people who were thinking these things up in South Africa, they weren't a bunch of idiots. They were actually highly educated people, and they were thinking big thoughts. And all the things that they came up with were fair and workable. If you understand apartheid, you would actually say it's actually one of the most humane ideas that has been put forward politically. It basically allows every single tribe, every single community to do its own thing. A definition that I never hear for apartheid these days, but it was a definition that I heard in the past, and which I actually think is the best definition. The definition you'll hear these days is that they'll talk about apartheid being good neighborliness. Verwoerd himself said that. He said that you've got a neighbor and you are good to your neighbor and you get along with your neighbor, but your neighbor doesn't live in your house. P.W. Botha said the same thing. He also spoke about good neighborliness, that apartheid is about, we're going to take people and put them in their areas. Everybody's got an area, and we will be happy as neighbors, but they're not going to live in our houses, kind of a thing. But the actual definition that I liked, that I used to hear in the past when I was younger, was separate development. I really think that the term separate development is so beautiful, and it's so accurate, and it's so realistic, and it's what actually happens. Like even now with whites doing their own thing and blacks doing their own thing. The concept of separate development, you cannot get a better concept at all. It says, we're going to develop the way that we want to develop, and you develop the way you want to develop. So if you want to be a communist, you go and do your communism in your homeland, and, you know, good luck to you, whatever happens to you. But in our place, we're going to function in some other way. And I like the concept of separate development as one of the best explanations for apartheid. It means that our thinking is not going to be the same as your thinking. And that's fine. You go and think whatever nonsense you want to think and do your nonsense in your own place. We're going to do our stuff our way, in a way that works for us. And that's that. But separate development, truly, to me, that has always been the best explanation. And having seen how life evolves afterwards, I must tell you, separate development, absolutely the best thing of all. It is applicable worldwide. So just like National Socialism, Fascism, etc., Jews have just been twisting and turning it, turning everything on its head, misrepresenting it. That's not what it was about. There was a thing called the Group Areas Act, and that controlled who's going to live where. So he goes on and he talks, oh, the Group Areas Act. Well, the Group Areas Act was basically what they were trying to do is they were trying to get people to go into their areas and put similar people in similar areas. They created like a township for the Indians, and all the Indians go and live in their township among other Indians. They didn't go and stick blacks among Indians or coloreds among blacks. They went and they created areas for everybody. I truly think it's the best way to live. If you must live among others, then it's the only sane way to do it. And I really think the whites had brilliant ideas. But the real issue is that the Jew is busy with his Jewish game. And as I mentioned in earlier parts of this, the Jews need the blacks. The Jews need everybody, because the Jews are going to take everybody and use them all together against whites. That's the real Jewish game. As you heard, he said that Dr. Verwoerd never raised his voice. He came across as a kindly uncle. And then he says, but he's mad and insane. It's a rerun of Hitler, because Verwoerd was a National Socialist. But that was not publicly known. But they hated Verwoerd. The Jews knew what was going on there. The Jews hated him because he was organizing things. One of the things that Verwoerd really worked on hard was he was very keen to unite all whites. He was trying his utmost to bring the English-speaking whites, which would include the Jews, because the Jews are also classified as white, and he was trying to bring everybody together to work together with the Afrikaans speakers. So it's a lot like the Germans in Germany and you're trying to get any other whites from other countries who are living inside Germany to work with the Germans. That's all that he was doing. And he was doing his utmost to bring all whites together. Verwoerd was very much a racialist. He wanted all whites, English and Afrikaans, to work together. And he was very successful up to a point, until you find that the Jews have been working on some of the English speakers, and that actually ends up becoming poor old Verwoerd's downfall. He goes on and on about Mandela's non-racist vision for the future South Africa. But I wonder if that is not just the Jewish vision, because Jews have a way of making their values become your values. You will notice that he also mentions that they had to have meetings secretly in the time of apartheid. That is because the South African government enacted a law called the Suppression of Communism Act. Rhodesia also had something like that. In other words, communism is illegal. I think it was a very wise thing that whites did in the past, and I have no problem with it. So these practicing communists had to then sneak around and hold meetings in secret. And as you've seen from the photo, Kasrils is giving this talk at a house, and he's saying that this is similar to the way they used to have secret meetings in houses. And from that, whites should also learn a lesson, is if you want to operate secretly, operate like these commies did, these commies and Jews. Go and have house meetings as National Socialists and as whites, supporting whites. Go and meet with your friends and have a house meeting. Do your politics there. These Jews and communists were sneaking around doing this all over South Africa. Jews and blacks and other assorted garbage were meeting in these houses in order to work towards their politics and the overthrow of the white government of South Africa. Just a point for those who might not know, when Kasrils uses the term MK, some Americans think that when you mention MK that you're talking about MK Ultra, which is a CIA program. No, in South Africa, MK has a specific meaning. MK is the abbreviation that they use for the term Umkhonto we sizwe. So they don't say Umkhonto we sizwe, they just say MK. And MK is basically the spear of the nation. That was what they called their army. And Ronnie Kasrils himself was one of the founding members of this violent terrorist communist organization. Kasrils himself was one of the founders. And there was another Jew as well that is very important that we're going to get back to, who was also a member of MK. But MK was the armed wing. So here is a Jew who was one of the founding members of the army that is going to fight against the whites. In any country, that would be called treason. But that's just a little bit of additional information regarding what he said there. But notice how, in this answer to my question, notice how Kasrils hates Verwoerd. It comes out clearly. Eventually, he doesn't say he hates him. He says, no, Verwoerd was insane, which he wasn't, of course. But they have to find ways to demonize those whom they see as the enemy. It's a rerun of Hitler and any other white who stood up for his race. In the next video, you'll get to listen to the entire discussion, and then you'll see how comfortable these Jews are with our enemies. You'll see how comfortable they are with communists, chatting to communists. Even the person hosting the meeting will talk with happiness and delight about communists. Oh, I met this communist. And you will see that these Jews are so comfortable among communists. All are enemies. They are meeting with this black and that Indian and so on. And all of them are enemies of the whites. They become people that we end up fighting against. And you'll see how comfortable and happy they are. And how they talk about how wonderful they are. Wonderful people. And it should make whites really think, you know, why are these Jews so friendly and talking so highly of those who plot our deaths? It should let you realize that there's something very wrong here. And yet these Jews had been allowed into South Africa and had been given great opportunities. But a long time ago, before that, the original whites who gained control of South Africa, including Verwoerd himself, had actually said and written in the 1930s that European Jews should not be allowed into South Africa. Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd wrote that in the 1930s. There were many things he wrote about the Jews, and he spoke about Jews controlling the economy in the 1930s already. And he spoke about these European Jews should not be allowed into South Africa. And all the other people who formed the political party that came to create apartheid, all of them in the early days, they had said and run on the platform that Jews should not be allowed into South Africa. Should not be allowed into South Africa. And the Jews know that. The Jews got into South Africa despite the fact that these whites knew that they were trouble. But that's a whole story for another day. But the battle between the National Socialist, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, and the Jews should be quite evident from this discussion with Kaz Rolls here. You'll see Kaz Rolls, no matter what a nice guy Verwoerd was, never raised his voice. In the end, Kaz Rolls has to say he's insane. Because the reality is that by any other measure, you cannot find fault with Verwoerd. But they know that Verwoerd was their enemy. So they have to try and find some way of justifying it. They, of course, never point out the problems that they bring, these European Jews. Some food for thought. In the next one, you'll get to hear the entire discussion. Everything that he said, what he said. And I think by the time you go through that, then you will have a good idea of these Jews of South Africa. And these people, they are not a part of the whites. And they do not think like the whites. And they see whites as a problem. And it's basically that here in South Africa, like in America, we are basically getting the whites and Jews clashing in a rerun of the clashes that have happened in Europe over the last more than 2,000 years. Same game is playing itself out. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourself.